You tuning in to All Yo Illuminata News, and we are here today with Matt Arrett, Canadian Patriot, and we're going to be going over a topic that I've been so fascinated about, and it's the Society of the Order of the Garter. It's a topic we're going to get into. It's going to be wild, and its connection to a huge reset that took place the exact same year the order was founded. The Black Death in England. Is this a coincidence? How are you doing today, Matt?
Yeah, it's a very provocative opening. Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I'm looking forward to this chat.
Me too. So right off the bat, what is the Order of the Garter?
I guess the textbook answer is it's a chivalric order established in 1348, although it was originally announced in 1344 by a king named Edward III. It's the highest ranking chivalric order in England. It involves, and there are many, you know, there's many chivalric orders. People know of the Knights Hospitaller, the Knights of Malta. There's the Order of Bath, the Order of St. Michael and St. George, so many knighthoods that have been created, most of them having their roots in the Crusades, the opening days of the Crusades that unleashed this massive centuries-long normalization of forever wars of religions. So this thing emerged at this period, and as you pointed out, it occurred at a very peculiar year of 1348, which is a conjunction of several major destructive historic, let's just say, things, which I think are quite connected. And you're showcasing on the screen right now different images of the Black Death, which the bubonic plague that made its appearance felt in a big way in June of 1348. And a series of religious wars as well that became known, or not even religious, but I think they were religious. I think they were kind of like a crusade that became known as the Hundred Years' War, a war between England and France that was also ushered in that very same year at the same time. So these are three big things, and this Order of the Garter still exists, leading figures within the royal families of Europe, even of Japan, are members. And it's very exclusive. They can have no more than 24 or 25 members on top of the sitting reigning monarch of England. So that's 26 members. And it's always, you always have the reigning monarch of England as the top sort of grandmaster, if you want to call it that. And you have the Prince of Wales. At the time, it was Edward III's son, the Black Prince, who is the Prince of Wales, who's always the head of another order. And we could like break down the occult significance of that. I guess that's unavoidable as we go forward into this conversation.
So Tony Blair, yeah. I guess he's the most recent of the 25 of this chivalric order.
Yeah, he's up there. I mean, he came in quite recently. I've been looking more at the historical backdrop of this thing, but I know you have certain figures. Again, Tony Blair, as Sir Tony Blair, who is a member of this thing. You have Emperor Naruhito, the claimant emperor of the throne of Japan, who's a member, as has been his father, Hirohito, and his father, who was used to usher in things like World War II, the Sino-Russo War as well, which was orchestrated by British grand strategists who were able to seduce and corrupt the mind and minds of certain royals in Japan to believe that just like England was destined in some mythical fantasy land to manage the world empire of the West, so too was Japan destined to manage as an island empire of princes, you know, superhuman princes, the world empire of the East. And there he is right there, Taisho, Emperor Taisho, who is a soft-minded fellow who got pulled into this operation and found himself basically overseeing the growth of a massive rehabilitation of the samurai ethos, which had formerly been taken down at the Meiji Restoration by certain progressive reformers who wanted to eliminate this Eastern chivalric system of esoteric knighthoods that was like a warlording bloodbath that these samurais, basically organized criminal mafias, were, you know, applying to manage Japan and their external world. That's the symbol itself of the Order of the Garter, with an image there in the center of the flag of Saint George, the red cross of Saint George's flag, which was originally also the symbol used for the Templars. They were actually mandated by the papacy to have the only chivalric order authorized to utilize the red cross, the rosy cross, on their insignia and in clothing. That was the Templars. But the Templars, by the time that the Order of the Garter was created, and there's a picture of a garter in a circle around it saying, "Only soit qui aille penser." So like, shame on he who thinks evil of it is sort of the loose translation. There's a story behind that as well. And so they basically, though the Templars were gone, and it is tied to the emergence of the Order of the Garter, I would actually say the Order of the Garter is likely a rebranded Templar, one of many rebranded Templar agencies that reemerged, you know, decades after the Templars were taken down by the father and grandfather of Edward III. So that's a part of the story as well.
Yeah. So this belt, the symbol, looks like a Q a little bit. You know, I see the symbols and the red shield I've talked about on my channel. It's not a coincidence that even Rothschild translates into the red shield. And even what we've been seeing during the lockdowns in America, you had two of these hospital boats circle the west and the east coast of America, and there's this big red cross on it. And even in the Middle East today, the people that are part of like the caravans and all that with the negotiations, the people in control of it seem to be the Red Cross. And I'm like, well, you know, these names, these symbols is what I'm very interested in. And it's just like so hidden. If someone just looks at this, they wouldn't even notice it's a belt. Because when I first saw it in studying the symbols, I didn't see it was a belt. And how important this is. Like, I didn't even know that, like, it said, like, a word that meant something. So I'm very happy you brought that up. And I've seen these belts and just even the queue. And I saw somebody post on Twitter on the Michael Jackson ranch has this symbol, which looks like it if you kind of, you know, gaze at it. I don't think it's pulling too much at some strings there, but this is what got me so fascinated in this order. And even in the news today, I'll just go to the slide quickly, but there's echoes of these events that change the world, even happening today, as we see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think that I mentioned that there's a story, an official story associated with the Garter, but I find it also interesting to keep in mind the unofficial stories that are promoted by certain occultists that are vetted, that also talk about their better understanding of some of these stories. Now, you always have to take this stuff with a grain of salt, because I'm speaking here about the Aleister Crowleyites, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn initiates, and people like, for example, Gerald Gardner, who is a disciple of Crowley and a founder of modern Wicca. And he had written a book in 1954 on the origins of witchcraft. I think it's called Witchcraft Today, where he does sort of an assessment and puts forth his view that the Order of the Garter and the origin of that story. There he is right there. Your Googling skills are very fast. You're fast on the on the mouse, man.
Yeah.
So just to be quick, he tells the story because the official story has it that a particular woman, I think a duchess, is at court and Edward III is there. And at one point, in the middle of this ball, her garter falls off her leg and he picks it up and tells the entourage that he's around to say, like, let no one who is evil think, or let shame on anyone who thinks evil of it, you know, implying that there may be that there was some assumptions of her loose conduct or whatever. Now, that's the official story. And then the name was given. He decided to name his new chivalric order of the Garter, in celebration of this moment. Yeah, creepy guy, eh? He really, like, lived into the image of the eccentric sorcerer in a cave. Yeah. But he was a really devious bastard. He was very smart, too. Again, disciple of Crowley. You don't, you know, raise that high up and live a long life and if you're a slacker. So, yeah, he's a witch.
I thought women were witches.
No. Men are witches too. In fact, that goes back to the Templars, who seem to have been witches. And Gerald Gardner also makes the point that the Knights Templar that were burned also in sort of the first witch trial, they were doing sorcery and witchcraft. There's a lot of solid evidence that substantiates that. So you don't have to be just a woman to be a witch. Of course, they have warlocks too, which typically are men. But they could be women, according to Gardner, as well, like women who assume the male energy. So basically, you know, if you can really tap into your inner lesbian and impose the will to power idea, then you can somehow play the role of a warlock as a female. That's just me reading Gerald Gardner. But Gardner also makes the point that that the not just the Templars, but that the Order of the Garter were also organized as witch covens. And a witch coven, as people know, has 13 members, you know, with a head witch at the top. And the Order of the Garter also had 26 members, which is two covens, one under the sitting monarch, the other one under the Prince of Wales. And that this particular duchess, whose name is escaping me, would have been, in his research, a leading witch of those days, who would have been in cahoots with Edward III. Maybe it was somebody providing him necromancy services or astrological or other incantations or, you know, and sexual services. God knows, you know, you can only speculate. But that his picking up her garter and putting it in his jacket was sort of like an affirmation that they're on the same page. Well, that's the Gerald Gardner official story. There's another woman named Anne Murray who Gerald Gardner uses. She's like sort of the modern, she wrote in the 1920s, but she sort of brought the study of witchcraft into anthropological, scientifically acceptable, you know, research. And I think she probably was a witch, frankly. You know, when you look at the way she's composing her assessments and coloring of the different stories of witch covens around Europe. But okay, so let's go back to the story of the Order of the Garter now. So you can't, like everything, it's context, right? And you've made the clear parallel to today that there was a great reset or a phoenixing ritual that was set into motion that was triggered at this particular moment in 1348 that coincided with a new age of terrible wars, the Hundred Years' War. Again, it's impossible to put words into the horror of the Hundred Years' War that Edward III ushered in. And who was it who ushered in the bubonic plague? Well, according to Barbara Tuchman, who is a pretty useful expert on the Black Plague and the dark, the little, what's called the Little Dark Age. Here, let me go get her book. One second.
The Little Dark Age. Wow.
Yeah, Barbara Tuchman. I got too many books on my bookshelf. I don't see it off the top of my head. But Barbara Tuchman wrote a book called is it The Mirror? Oh, it's up here somewhere. I'll get it later. So she basically did a study which pointed out that the cause of the Black Death, which resulted in the depopulation of Europe. Hey, Harry Ludwig, how you doing? The depopulation of Europe to the tune of half of the population in many of the city centers of Europe in 1347, 48, 49. Half like of Paris of, and it was ubiquitous. It was spread out everywhere. That strange plague actually had a lot more to do with the collapse of the financial system, which at that point had been sort of held together by a massive speculative Ponzi scheme, centered on several banking houses of Italy that had extended loans. I think they were very much tied to the Templars, which had formerly, you know, near monopoly rights over global banking, for the 250 years that they were active, or 300 years that they were, you know, 250 years that they were active. And they didn't lose, even though the popular story goes that they were shut down and disappeared in 1314. Not true. Their banking interests, their land holdings, their castles, their other assets and farming, their control over water systems and wells that every urban society needed to access to get their basic water was very much under the control still of the Templars, even when they changed their names, when they went to Portugal, Spain, England in the form of several organizations, and including the Knights Hospitaller, which kind of merged with the Templars. They got access to a number of their holdings, but then still continued to do the same thing. That's their nominally rival order. What you're looking at there, some of the images of the Knights of the Order of St. John of Jerusalem there, which is on the left. You got on the further left, upper left, is the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre that were also set up in 1098, the same year as the Knights of the Order of St. John. You got a number of these chivalric orders.
From the book about the Order of the Garter, just showing their symbols, just if people are wondering. From this book, Order of the Garter, Laws and Ceremonies.
And they very much use the rosy cross as well. The rose and the cross symbolisms, which become, you know, useful a little bit later on when the Rosicrucian Order is created, or at least comes out of the closet in that form in 1614, although it had been incubating for a number of years before that. So what am I getting at? I don't want to get too off topic at the moment, right? Just to get across that the triggering of the Black Plague that depopulated Europe resulted in a complete loss of faith, a massive spike of cults, heretical cults, because people lost all faith in conventional religion. You know, the monks, the priesthoods were very corrupt. Not all. There were some really good people in the Catholic Church, but a lot of it was corrupt, and a lot of it came out publicly at that period. Another thing that the papacy screwed up on is they said during the Black Plague, where people were like seeing their whole families wiped out, death was so normalized. It was crazy. They were dumping bodies in the water systems too, which was not helping. Is that the Pope ended up putting out a papal bull saying that the reason why the Black Death is happening, just so you all know, is because God's punishing us for our sins. And the people were like, okay, well that sucks. So you're exacerbating their sense of self-hate and shame and loathing. So that's not good for the mass traumatized psyche, but at the same time you're admitting that like all of these churches are also corrupt because they're also being punished. So you're basically admitting through that papal bull that the whole edifice of religion is actually corrupt and God's punishing everybody for that, right? So it resulted in a massive spike of end times cults, millennial cults, that were all a saying that now is the confirmation of the end times. People were going into hedonism because, you know, live for the day. If there's no future, might as well just be the beast, be the most fleshly, perverse beast that you could be, you know. So raping, pillaging, all of these things was super also popular at this time, like roving tribal gangs, kind of like what they're doing in Netflix shows today by promoting the. Oh, yeah, sorry, I just lost my connection. Kind of like what they're trying to acclimate our minds to do today, to think about these post-apocalyptic scenarios where everybody's got, like, fighting to survive in some post-apocalyptic wasteland with their local, with their mini gang, you know, and everybody's got this like, basically. So all that to say, so you got this going on, right?
Well, I mean, and we just came out of the lockdowns itself, and what was the like number one show? Was Squid Games and stuff like this. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you got that going on. You've got what's the Hundred Years' War about? Well, the Hundred Years' War, which at this point the economy is wiped out. I didn't mention Barbara Tuchman makes the point that the banking collapse of the Bardi and Peruzzi banking houses, which were the dominant lending, like usurious banking houses, went bust. The trigger that caused them to collapse and then destroy the supply chains, the credit that was needed to keep the economy basically functional, melted down. And it was premised on the fact that you had speculation in the wool markets. And it was the King of England, Edward III, who in 1346 defaulted on all of his debts. He just defaulted. And that set the trigger, the chain reaction trigger of a mass wave of defaults of everybody trying to go to the banks to pull out their money. But the banks were like, well, we actually don't have any of that money. That was all just like promissory notes. So that breakdown resulted then in a total annihilation of the means of just carrying out basic trade, and the sanitation systems also collapsed. Everything else went with that. The food production collapsed. So then you have both food production, sanitation being annihilated, jobs are being annihilated, and the Black Plague is also being spread in that climate. Now, what's causing it? You know, I don't know what's causing it. I know I've been told that it was specifically fleas on rats that would like bounce around and somehow get into people and give them the plague. I've been told that. Is that true? I don't know if that's true. At the time, many people were postulating that wells were being poisoned, or, you know, that maybe toxic poisons were being spilled by design in a coordinated fashion in urban wells and even rural wells across the world. Primarily Europe, but it spread even beyond that. It spread to, you know, the Middle East and Africa as well. So to what degree do you have coordination that can do something like that? I don't know, but I'm open to the possibility. I know that there was also like a lot of roving hordes that massacred Jewish towns. Like tens and tens of thousands of Jewish towns were massacred. Men, women, and children were burned alive because of the anti-Semitic hysteria, you know, that was rampant in those days. Everybody wanted somebody to blame. And because at the time, the Jews also, like the Jewish populations, tended to have slightly better sanitary practices than those outside of the towns, they were blamed for their much lower death count during the plague. So because you survived the plague, maybe with a slightly less high death count than other populations, that all of a sudden became enough evidence to convince these roving hordes that you were the cause of it, and that these Jews were poisoning the wells. And again, you can see the historic accounts of city by city breakdowns during 1347, 48, 49, or 48, 49, especially, of just total massacres. It was people went crazy. Does that mean that it's 100% of a lie? I wouldn't discard the total hypothesis that, in a sense, we know that there were like Kabbalistic, very evil dark magicians who were utilized by the Templars that came out of, you know, Sephardic areas in Africa and the Middle East, and then were deployed to manage a lot of the banking operations as Hofjuden. So could they, who were more witches, like dark magicians, than they were Jews, but they had Jewish names, doing not keeping a surface appearance of being Jews, but not actually really being that at all. Just like the Templars weren't Christian at all. They were Johannite Gnostics following a Mithraic ritual, as were most of these initiates of these orders. Could they have been also participants of this sacred ritual murder? Possibly so. And could they have blamed happily and thrown under their bus their own lower, you know, uninitiated Jewish towns and stuff? And possibly so. I wouldn't discard any of these hypotheses. I'm saying it the way I'm saying it because people tend to get very black and white into either total mainstream narratives that deny everything I'm saying, or they go full hog, radical, it's all the Jews. You know? And they miss all of these very important nuances of how this shit actually goes down. So you have the controlled breakdown of the banking system, the buildup of a bubble where there once was a viable economy, and the blowing up of the bubble, not dissimilar from the type of structure that we're currently living through today with a bubble economy that could easily be triggered by any one of a number of picks that a pin could be put into to default on a number of types of securitized debts that could blow out the whole system, right? So there's very similar triggers there. We got the laying out of an excuse of depopulation by starvation, shutting down of supply chains, food production, but also exacerbations of bacteriological warfare, which might very well be what was spreading through the food system or more likely the water systems. Then you have the danger of wars. And as we've seen with Pete Hegseth, you might want to Google here Pete Hegseth with his particular tattoo, right? That's a guy who's just like, he's written a book, his manifesto, before he got political office, calling for American crusade against effectively Islam and Chinese communism. So he's calling for reorganizing the American identity and rehabilitating American patriotism around reviving medieval crusader knighthoods and the spirit of crusade against evil monsters that we should go out and try to destroy abroad. Now, if you look at those, when people see the image of Pete Hegseth, if they've not seen it already, they'll be startled that he decided that the tattoo he wanted for his chest is that particular one right there, which is the symbol of the Holy Sepulcher, the order of the Holy Sepulcher that was set up in 1098 to oversee the actual so-called the temple built upon the supposed location where Jesus was put up on the cross. That's at least as the story goes, which apparently features fragments of the cross itself, which is part of the whole cult of the relics. This idea that there's these mystical powers associated with various relics, the hair of Jesus will sell and did sell in the Middle Ages for castles, you know, not to say that anybody could prove that that was the actual hair or little vial of blood of Jesus or a little piece of splinter from the cross. It was basically a giant scam artist movement, but that's made a comeback today. And this guy is a big believer in the restoration of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And that was that sepulcher symbol became the image for the Kingdom of Jerusalem for the 200 plus years that it did exist as a crusader kingdom. I think it was around the 1290s or 1280 period, 1290s that it ceased to be run by Templars and Crusaders. The Arabs took it back, or the Muslims took it back, that whole area. But there's been a dream to restore it again. And this is also very much tied, for those who don't know, to the belief in the restoration of Solomon's Temple, which is what the Poor Knights of King Solomon's Temple, aka the Templars, were devoted to rebuilding as they made their base under Solomon's stables, which is today's location for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Also, it's a location that is also apocryphally, and I mean, I'm not saying I believe that this is even the location. It's not the location, but, you know, there's a rock, a big stone under there, which is the reputed stone where Abraham was told to sacrifice his son to God and was stopped by the angel before he could do the sacrifice. And certain occultists who believe this shit presume that that was a center of global human sacrifice for the ancient mysteries, the ancient mystery religions. And they've had a fetish and obsession about reviving that practice at some point to usher in a new age post-reset. And that was what the Templars were also committed to doing under Solomon's minds. And rebuilding Solomon's temple a third time was part of their ambition. That's also what Pete Hegseth is on record. You can go to YouTube and listen to his speech in Israel, reaffirming his devotion to the building of Solomon's temple, the third temple. So he's part of the Christian Zionist third temple cult, and also not just Zionist, more than that, Crusader Templar view. So these Crusaders, what they seem to do is they will use Jews. They will use the Jews, whether in banking to do dirty work and then to receive often the pitchforks of the angry mobs that get burned by the financial warfare and throw them under the bus. They will reward some of those Jews that do their job really sociopathically well, maybe the Rothschilds, maybe the Montefiores, maybe the Sassoons, and they'll give them more responsibilities, but they're always under the control grid of the higher managerials. And the same thing for, I think, today's what's in play now in the Middle East is I think that ultimately those like Hegseth or like even J.D. Vance, who when J.D. recently went to Israel, he actually just bypassed the Wailing Wall and he made a big controversy because everyone's like, ah, you're supposed to go to the Wailing Wall. And he didn't do that. He instead went to the Holy Sepulchre. That's where he spent his time before coming back to the USA. So I think that you've got a movement, and he represents sort of the Peter Thiel unification of the theobro and technobro ideologies that are sort of being unified under this new elite. So all that to say, this is part of the thing is they need to use the disposable Zionists in order to usher in a cataclysmic situation that will then purge that land of those people living there in order to justify a reconstitution of Templar strongholds in a kingdom of Jerusalem in a geostrategically more useful place to Eurasia that they wish to prepare to go to war with for the coming several centuries, as it's more just strategically located in the area where all of these ancient civilizations all kind of meet in that area of the Holy Land, as we know it geographically, right? Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, Central Europe, or Europe more broadly on the Mediterranean. Then you have Russia, the broader Eurasian and Chinese civilizations all kind of intersect in that zone. So whoever could keep a dominant control of that zone is in the best position to keep everybody fighting and disrupting any possible emergence of real cooperation. So that's part of the geopolitical material conceptions. But then the thing you and I are talking about is also and primarily the cultural, spiritual strategies here. So going back to the Order of the Garter, I think that the unleashing of the Hundred Years' War was also the third element, the Black Plague, triggering of the banking collapse, the creation of this new Templar secret order of witches. And the unleashing of, so what, why did the Hundred Years' War happen? That's a good one. So for those who don't know, the Hundred Years' War was basically, it was England versus France initiated by Edward III. And the idea was, well, he's the king of France. He's not just the king of England. He's the king of France. Why is he the king of France? Well, he said, well, my grandpa is, Philip le Bel. And because my grandpa is Philip le Bel, Philip IV of France, thus I am totally entitled hereditarily to the kingdom of France. And it's true. Philip le Bel, he wasn't lying, was his grandfather. Why? Well, because Philip le Bel, who Philip le Bel was?
Who?
He's the guy, he was the king that declared war on the Templars. He's the guy who arrested Jacques de Molay.
Oh, okay. Right.
That happened in 1307, where Philip le Bel of France decides enough is enough. And it began a little bit earlier where he's like, we've got to actually start in 1302, where he said, okay, the rule, no longer will I recognize the Templars as being something outside the law, which is what they were claiming, that they had supernational power outside of the laws of the Kingdom of France. Because, oh, there you go. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, King Philip le Bel of France, Philip IV. And so he said, no, he passed a law that basically said everybody in France, including Templars, have to abide by the rule of the King of France. Nobody's exempt. And at the same time as he does this, so this is war now, because the Templars are allowed to collect their own taxes. They have massive land and financial holdings. Like, they could do whatever they want, right? That's the organized mafia. They're running protection rackets in all of the villages. They've got their own private armies. Like, it's crazy the power that they have. So it's courageous that this guy can do it. And he's also very slandered. Like, a lot of people, they get very triggered if you say anything positive about Philip le Bel. Philip le Bel is also simultaneously, and I discovered this when Cynthia and I went down to Avignon a few months back to visit a friend, and we were doing a little bit of research. We went to the Philip le Bel castle just outside of Avignon, and they have some information displays. And the thing that caught my eye is that they point out, and I didn't see this on any Wikipedia entry or any research that I was doing, I did not see this except at the castle, where they make the point that he actually declared war on the feudal Norman barons and the feudal barons more generally that had brought feudalism into France. That's a big deal that he was pulling off this massive anti-corruption war to end the for people who don't know what feudalism is, that's feudalism is the ownership of people who live on the land that the Lord owns. So the people have the same rights as pigs, pretty much. And they're not allowed to venture off their land to another district if they don't have special permission from the Lord. If they kill a rabbit without permission, then they will be tortured, often murdered. That the lords who preside over the local princes who preside over their different fiefdoms typically had total right to have sex with any woman, including married women, young girls on their land. So it was a really bad period, you know, and they didn't really allow literacy during this period. I got to say, just completely melted down. The written word, the printed texts was annihilated during this period of the Crusades and especially the Black Death. So this is what Philip le Bel is declaring war on. He does this thing. He says the Templars have to abide by the law of the nation. The Pope Boniface the eighth, but I could be wrong. The Pope at the time steps in and says, no, you don't have the right to put this type of limitation on the Templars. The Templars are the personal hand of the papacy, of the Pontifex Maximus. And as such, it is the king of the various nations of Europe that have to be obedient serfs to the Pontifex Maximus and the power of the hand of the pontiff, which is the Templars. And so there's this battle. Now, Philip le Bel ends up doing a raid right before he could be excommunicated by that pope, because that was the plan, was to excommunicate him, at which point it becomes more easy to do a regime change of an illegitimate king. Before that excommunication act could be read aloud to the public, Philip le Bel organizes a massive raid on the papacy and ends up imprisoning Pope Boniface, who is the defender of the Templars. Boniface ends up dying in like a dungeon. That's him right there. So he ends up like dying in a dungeon. And there's a fight over like who's going to control the papacy going forward. Now, Philip ends up getting one of his allies from the south of France. I think it's not Avignon, but it's nearby, to become the Pope. And that becomes Pope Clement V. And Pope Clement V ends up working very closely with Philip le Bel at taking down the Templars. The first thing that they do is they set a trap and they promise Jacques de Molay, who's then the Grand Master, that, okay, if you come to this special meeting, this party we're going to have for you, we will finally grant your permission to have another crusade. Because that's sort of like the creative vitality of the Templars is crusades. If you don't have crusade, you lose your edge. You peter out. You lose your raison d'être. So the Molay comes with some of his top you know Templar knights, and the trap is set, and they basically get arrested. And the arrest, you know, it happens as it does, and criminal proceedings and inquiries begin, judicial investigations, utilizing a lot of whistleblowers, a lot of infiltrators, agents of the crown who had been sent in to see if the claims of witchcraft were true. Were they actually true that the Templars were basically pissing on or walking on and even pissing on the cross and renouncing Christianity in their secret initiatory rites? Were they doing sacred homosexual acts, which is how the witches pass on their superpowers, as they believe, from one to the other, is through sex, special kinds of sex, not just vulgar sex, of course, right? Special sex. But it's supposed to be under the typical witch formula, male to a female witch that passes on the powers. Whereas in the Templars, which allow for no females, it's kind of difficult to pass on powers and to bring on people into the new initiatory rites unless you're doing it the other way. So that's another aspect of what's brought forth. Also the worshiping of a demon figure named Baphomet is brought up. Probably not at that time the same symbolic image of the Baphomet that we kind of think of that was popularized by Eliphas Levi in the 19th century, featuring the androgynous goat human with partial serpent pointing up and down to the eclipsed sun and the eclipsing moon. That's probably not the same image that they were using, that they were worshiping. That's the one that Eliphas Levi designed. But it might have had some similarities that basically incorporates Pan, which is a hedonistic Dionysian image of Saturn and Satan, the consuming god of the material realm. That Pan image is, you know, the half man, half goat was used by the Pied Piper symbology. It was, again, tied to Bacchanalian revelry and pedophilia, the rape of maidens as well as young boys, and sacrifice. Human sacrifice was a big part of this Dionysiac Bacchanalian kind of ritual. So that, you know, you see that symbolism within that version of Baphomet, but it was still existent back then too. The version that it seems most likely that the Templars were worshiping had a severed head, whether it was a skull, it was probably deformed. Likely it had a deformed baby was the biggest, the most provocative theory that I've seen so far, that it was probably a baby, maybe born with two heads. Whether it was killed in ritual or whether it was born deformed and died, I don't know. But it seems like that was probably a symbol. You see it also coming up in certain shows on Netflix, the enamorment of the sacredness of babies with malformed heads or dual or even tri heads. They see this stuff as really sacred in alchemical ritual for some reason. Maybe it implies Janus or some dual face dualism that they think is metaphorically expressed by these cases of animals with two heads or humans ideally with two heads. That probably goes for a lot of money. So, and then there's other theories too about, you know, Baphomet being sort of a merger of Baal and Muhammad. And I've not verified if those are true. I'm just saying that they're floating around and it's open to some degree of speculation, but all that to say, back to the story of the Order of the Garter and why it was that Philip le Bel said, "I am the King of France. I have the right because," or that Edward III said that because Philip le Bel was his grandfather. Well, okay. So to do this properly, is that the Templars weren't only located in France. They were everywhere. And a big hub that the Templars had was in England. The problem was England and France were typically at loggerheads for a long time. So how do you get some coordination on taking down this type of structure? Well, a peace treaty had to be developed. And the way this was done was Philip le Bel organized that his daughter be married off to Edward II of England. And that consolidated an English-French peace treaty. And that way, in England as well, they were able to simultaneously take down the Templars under Edward II's control. He really didn't like the Templars. It wasn't just because, and we're told by, I would say, Templar revisionism of this history, that Philip le Bel is a shithead. He just didn't want to pay his debts to the Templars. He wanted to become a Templar. He got rejected, and that's why he just wanted to destroy them. You know, so there are these cartoonish caricatures that ignore all of this deeper reality that I'm getting across here. And so Edward II is doing this. He's taking down the Templars too. And so part of his thing involves needing to try to rein in Robert the Bruce. And Robert the Bruce, by this point, you know, the Templars are burned at the stake in 1314. Most of the Templars escape and sort of not even escape, but they kind of move their headquarters to several locations. One key location that Jacques de Molay deploys one of his key initiates is Edinburgh, which becomes sort of the base of the new, what becomes later on the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And the Edward the Bruce makes an arrangement, an agreement with the Templars that they will help him with, because they're shock troops. The Templars are shock troops. That's their thing. At least the one out of 10 Templars is shock troops, because the majority of Templars were actually bankers and administrators and they were like the deep state. But for those who were mercenaries who had the job of killing following the order of Clairvaux, well, they were shock troops. And they had all sorts of techniques of militia asymmetrical warfare, guerrilla tactics that were very useful for Robert the Bruce, who had earlier backstabbed William Wallace, right? So just a little bit before that, William Wallace was totally backstabbed by Robert the Bruce. And he allowed William Wallace to get drawn and quartered and chopped up into pieces after days of torture. William Wallace does seem to be cool. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe he was actually an occult asset. I don't think I'm wrong, but I might be. That being said, Robert the Bruce definitely stabbed him in the back. But Robert then also ends up becoming the claimant to the throne of Scotland. And he's assisted greatly by the arrangement he makes with the Templars, who now train and work with him to apply the types of guerrilla tactics they developed in the Middle East to battling the English crown of Edward II, who's basically, you know, treated as the one-dimensional supervillain or villain in the story, who does get defeated and he loses, control of Scotland for a very long time. Again, Scotland becomes a hub of the occult at this point, and it grows. And this is where the later Scottish Rite that infiltrates the United States plays a big role. The Scottish Rite was constituted in that form in 1802 in South Carolina. But it had already
existed under South Carolina is where that breakout's happening right now. Interesting.
Keep that in mind. All right, data point. So, you know, you have the battle against feudalism, the battle against these Gnostic orders, the banking orders. And what do you got as well is so Edward II is losing control during the 1310s, 1320s. He's really losing his control, his grip on things. His wife, the daughter of Philip le Bel, she's playing games. She ends up having a boyfriend who basically forces Edward II to abdicate, or else he'll be killed. And his own son, Edward III, who's a young teenager at this time, is siding with the mom and the boyfriend. So this boyfriend ends up taking control for like 2 minutes. Edward II abdicates. A witch, this is actually openly acknowledged, is that there's several covens of witches in 1324 who are carrying out curses on Edward II with little wax dolls and stuff. And it's attributed, at least in the mind of the witch coven culture or underculture today, followers of Gerald Gardner, that they were the cause. They induced the spirits, whatever, to kill Edward II, who dies soon thereafter in 1325. And then his son, his sort of treacherous wife, has overseen now the son being brought in as the new king. His new kid, and this kid is Edward III. Edward III has worked on heavily. He's got a giant, giant ego. He believes he's fed from a young age all of these Grail romances and Arthurian legends and mystery plays that were the Grail romances of Lancelot and the initiated, you know, knights that are tapped on the shoulder to go and find the Holy Grail and other quests. So he's drunk on this type of propaganda that's ubiquitous in the French kingdom, the English kingdom at this period. So yeah, right. That's a picture of Edward III there with the St. George's cross and Order of the Garter symbol on his tunic. So what is he? He's worked on to the point that he believes it's his mandate to usher in a new age. But somehow, as is always the case with these occultists who believe that they're ushering in some new age, it requires a massive purgative bloodletting, right? Like, they can't just do it in a way that involves like ending hunger and giving everybody a beautiful purpose to life by building up jobs and infrastructure. No. It has to involve massive slaughter first of most people alive, and then you could have a new age somehow, is the promise. And so he gets the idea that we got to launch a war with France. And so first he sets up the Order of the Garter. They do these multi-day rituals. He revives what's called the Arthurian Roundtable in his first 1344 ritual, where it's like 8 days long, and he brings together all of the nobles and the Norman chivalry, the Norman robber barons to his court, who are prospective members of his soon to be witch coven of knights. And they do jousting, and they do like several days of very weird ceremonies in secret with women in one part of the castle, men in the other. And it's a very weird.
Is it weird, like Arthurian, like author, like the author story of?
Yeah, yeah, that's that. Those Arthurian legends were very popular between the 12th and 14th centuries in a big way, and they were. What they were effectively Eleusinian mystery plays. So if you want to get a sense of like what the purpose they served, it wasn't to simply entertain. They had a sacred purpose. Yeah, that's the Lady of the Lake. And what they did is they embedded certain archetypes that were developed during the Eleusinian mystery plays of the ancient world, that were designed to bring initiates into a state of mind of radical self-importance, that you're the star of your own movie, that you are like, yeah. And it detaches you, right, from your humility, your natural human faculties. When you get into that like mindset where I want to be Harry Potter, I want to be the star of this fantasy land that's been built up for me. And that's what was very useful at recruiting knights to the Mithraic Mysteries that became sort of the warrior secret society that ran the Praetorian Guard and the legions of the Roman Empire. And that became the foundation of, and it's a male only warrior cult of initiatory rites that became the foundation for the creation of the Hospitallers and especially the Templars. So all that to say, it's just pictures of more Arthurian stuff. Now these had nothing to do, just so people know, and I've got a friend named Gerald Therrien, who's a wonderful researcher, and he developed a great thesis and a class for my Rising Tide Foundation that people can watch. It's a great thing to watch, and he did an accompanying essay where he goes through the real King Arthur from the 6th century, utilizing probably one of the only reliable, honest sources named Geoffrey of Monmouth or Monmouth. And Gerald Therrien's essay in class is fantastic because he gets across that there is evidence of a very real Arthur who did something extremely important in defense of King Arthur. That's the lecture that everybody can watch. It's great because it shows you the real man himself and the real Merlin and and there was no Lancelot, but the real Guinevere and the real networks in political history that were operating to try to stop what Arthur was doing and it's an incredible story. But just to get I'm saying this just to get people to realize that the stories of the Grail legends that came after Geoffrey of Monmouth's recounting of the history of England have nothing to do with reality. It's total fiction, including the sorceresses of Morgan Le Fay and who's the sometimes sister of Arthur and lover of Arthur who hates and loves Arthur. So you got all these like weird unifications of the sacred and the profane of the divine feminine embedded in some of these witches, these court female priestesses that, there were real people like Eleanor Aquitaine, who was a big sponsor of a lot of these Grail legends, and the troubadours who were also spreading the Grail legends to different parts of Europe. And like people like, anyway, there's a number of things like that are going on that are just part of like the Hollywood of its day that's designed to ritualistically incubate crazy people who will become self-important wannabe knights that are going to be used and, if necessary, discarded in oligarchical wars. So you got that going on. Now, Edward III is being fed and drunk on this crap. So he's of the belief that, okay, we've got these prophetic movements in place that he has a timeline by which to manifest certain apocalyptic prophecies. There's a promise of some new age that he's going to usher in, of some golden age. And so he has to do all of these things and he does them, which coincided with him saying, okay, I want France. And of course his major advisors, which are these Viking Normans, like the Normans that are running the feudalism of England that came in with the Norman invasion a few centuries earlier from France. They still have their holdings in France, right? A lot of these Norman billionaires, basically, they have still massive holdings in France. So they also want to get more control of what they believe is their right to control all of France. So they're using their asset. Edward, he's using them. Everybody's using everybody to basically get this war going. And so then you get a 100-year bloodletting on top of everything else, which doesn't stop until the War of the Roses. But the War of the Roses is another 30 years war in England between different factions of the Plantagenets, Lancaster versus York. These different, you know, princely houses are battling it out, killing each other for another 30 years in, there it is, War of the Roses from, what year is that? That's, well, that's, you move too fast there, but I, yeah.
And they're all married to each other. The cousin war.
The cousin's war, exactly. Yeah, this is often the case, right? Till 1487. And so what finally ends this is an Augustinian movement that rallies itself around a philosopher king by the name of Henry VII, Tudor, who forces now a bit of a positive coup that puts the Plantagenets out of power because they're just running roughshod on everything. And Henry VII brings in Augustinian, Platonic Christian, massive reforms, the likes of which we had seen attempted a century earlier by Philip le Bel in France, but now they're actually being done by Henry VII, who sets into motion what becomes the first nation state. Now he's at this point working with a collaborator to create another Anglo, like an English-French alliance between Louis XI, who's his friend, and he's really inspired by King Louis XI of France and his reforms to take down the feudal lords and to provide for the general welfare by investing treasuries into peacemaking initiatives, infrastructure, training of orphans with new schools, forcing monks and people in monasteries to start doing useful labor instead of just sitting there accumulating, you know, just sucking the lifeblood of society. So, you know, you have this movement, but the thing that, and Cynthia's doing some amazing work on a lot of this. Oh, John and Gaunt. Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole side.
And thing. You got that, or the symbol, the Order of the Garter, like belt right there. Yeah. And then the crown at the top.
Yeah. Yeah. John of Gaunt is the great grandfather of Henry VII Tudor. Henry VII actually does quite a bit to rein in the excesses of the Order of the Garter. He can't get rid of it, but he's trying to sort of, he puts massive constrictions on it. Like he forces the dames of the Garter to be dissolved. So you can't have these sacred feminine characters initiated as basically sorceresses into the thing. He tries to like limit what it can do. It's still a very powerful thing nonetheless.
And then I did a video when I first started the channel on how most of our presidents are, a lot of them are related to John of Gaunt. I think it's like Hillary and President Trump related, like, or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is like Trump is also tied genetically speaking to Robert the Bruce as well. Yeah, there's another from the other line. This is from his mom's side. There's another line that ties him to Edward III, actually. A Plantagenet. So he's not necessarily tied to the Tudors, but to the Plantagenets of Edward III, which also for me causes me to, I'm not saying that somebody is culpable for the crimes of their ancestors. Nobody's saying that. But when you have these types of occultists in play running games that put a high value on bloodlines and that they use to indoctrinate new generations into thinking that they're somehow somebody special, because Harry Potter had to have parents who were super wizards, right? He couldn't be a muggle and do that. You had to be from special, you know, special family lineages to have those abilities. So, you know, that's kind of like really what they do teach amongst these Rosicrucian and witch coven traditions, is that, you know, if you're not born of the special bloodline, you can't, which usually means some hereditary nobility in your background, some, then you can't even aspire to, you know, play a role in anything, you know, be for prepared sure. to just be a different type of slave, maybe, mm-hmm. you know.
And but also on top of just everything, with the bloodlines are very important, and mm-hmm. The War of the Roses, you have York, and like we have New York today, and then you have Lancaster, and then California, I think Lancaster is like one of the cities. So even the dragon lines or the rose lines of America, because there's so much Templar like buildings here in America. America is very Templar. I don't think that's a mistake having New York, York, and even seeing the Lancaster, California, they got the Lancaster. But that's kind of what I always do, is kind of connect the dots to what, you know, people understand of today, you know.
yeah. Well, you know, you have there's definitely it's good to train the mind to be able to do that. York again is big in Ontario.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, there's Yorktown, and all that to say, yes. So that should not be ignored, any of that stuff. And somebody I just realized that there are these comments going on. Somebody had mentioned a question about Dagobert or the Merovingian, which is a reference to the Merovingians. And yeah, that plays a big role in this whole story too, because Eleanor Aquitaine, who's this priestess, she actually is the mother of King Richard the Lionhearted, the Crusader King, that is working with the... What are you looking at there? Oh, the Merovingians. Okay, yeah, that's the Matrix Merovingian. So he's working actually with these Muslim Templar orders called the Hashashins, the Assassins, as well. And he's actually using them to kill his enemies, his Christian enemies, that he believes are holding him back from taking the control he deserves in the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So Richard the second, who by the way also got a tattoo of the Kingdom of Jerusalem on his chest, which was then replicated 800 years later by King Edward the Seventh, who is the first royal since Richard the Lionheart to go down. He's still the prince at Edward Albert when he goes in 1862 into Palestine with a delegation that becomes the foundation of what's known as the Quatuor Coronati Lodge. The Freemasonic Research Lodge. And he then goes, oh, that's a useful book. I have that. Yeah. Because that guy, James Wasserman, is himself an Ordo Templi Orientis high initiate. So he's vetted to tell this kind of like narrative, which has a lot of useful stuff. There's also a lot of garbage in it. But if you know what to look for and pay attention to, it's very useful for research.
Now, was it hard for you to read this? Because it was difficult for me to read.
I'm underlining stuff. I'm just taking notes as I'm reading and seeing what I can Google and verify or whatever afterwards. But it's useful for leads, you know. Like, I'm not necessarily gonna when it comes to a book like this, not to go too off topic, but what I'd advise is to use them for leads and ignore any value judgments made about anything by the author. So you're just like looking for the data that they're bringing that otherwise would be ignored, because their attention is on the right things that are otherwise ignored by mainstream sources. So because their attention is on the right things, they're appreciating the black magic undertones shaping history that are often totally ignored. That's useful. And then you're like taking note of like the names of orders, certain dates, certain interesting anomalies of collusion between the Templars and Assassins. So I'm just taking notes. And then I'm going to do the work afterwards of trying to use those as leads to find what is a more truthful story of why these anomalies happened, you know. And sometimes I find that they're lying about things. Sometimes, oftentimes the facts are truthful facts that are of value for my research. So,
right. Yeah. That's very, very wicked smart. I got this book. I haven't read it yet, but Stephen Knight, The Brotherhood, I believe it's called. And I also got Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which I haven't read, but I was trying to see if I could find words of the Order of the Garter in it, but it's doesn't like say it like.
No, I mean, roughly, you gotta really read between the lines. Yeah, you gotta read between the lines a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. The most, it's been pretty difficult to get anything straight on the Order of the Garter that's useful, that's not just kind of like lipstick stuff. But I found with Cynthia, because both of us have read through, Cynthia's doing this incredible series on the deep structure of the Rosicrucians, and some of the work that she's read, and I, you know, we've shared this, these books by Francis Stone, Francis Yates, who's sort of a high level raconteur of this Rosicrucian retelling of deep history. And again, just like this guy Wasserman, she's mostly lying about value judgments of things, but her data, what she's looking at, is highly useful because she's writing this for fellow Rosicrucians. She's kind of like a, playing the role of a memory keeper, so that because they also need to transmit their own narratives, you know, down through generations. That's not easy to do. Things dissipate, you know, but there's games of telephone. So to keep certain common narratives, they have to vet, they have to get certain vetted raconteurs to be the official storytellers that create and compile this information for the edification of their own initiates. But at the same time, they have to also provide for a version of the story for the masses to become confused about what actually was the cause of the Renaissance or the American Revolution or anything that puts them off the real path of the real story and makes them believe everything is just some black magic ritual and nothing else. So that's also useful for the empire to get their victims to think that that's the case. So I'm just saying that to get across. Okay, so back to the question of the Merovingians. See, I sometimes fall off my trail, but usually I can get back on the train, right?
Yeah, my bad.
No. I love segues too. I love them, as people know. But sometimes I 80% of the time I can get back on it and tie bows into things, right? But somebody had asked in the chats about the Merovingians and Dagobert. So if you go to Aquitaine, which is, again, Eleanor of Aquitaine, just to recap, and I recap things just as I know this stuff is fleeting. It doesn't stick in the mind, especially if somebody's just like driving to work or they're just listening to this sort of thing. What I'm hoping when I do these kinds of shows with you or anybody is that I'm saying things that will make people want to do their own work by reading the books we've written, that my wife has written, and do your own research projects that will cause these words, these thoughts, to move from opinion into earned knowledge. That's my opinion. That's my hope. And I know that part of it involves a certain amount of recapitulation. So.
Wow. And everybody go subscribe to Matthew's channel, Canadian Patriot, Matt Arrett channel down below, and grab his books. You're going to absolutely love them.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, appreciate that. So Eleanor Aquitaine, who is the mother of Richard the Lionheart, and another king of England later on, she's somebody who at two points in her life, she is both the queen of France and then becomes the queen of England at different times. These two countries being at war with each other at the time that she's queen of both. So that's wicked.
That's weird.
Her grandfather is the world's first troubadour, who seems to have gotten a certain esoteric initiatory experience in the south of Spain, in certain Sufi quarters that were maintaining very dark magic mystery beliefs. So a lot of these troubadour grail stuff seems to actually have a certain coloring by certain Gnostic, Sufi, Zoroastrian, Manichaean orders as well. It's good to keep in mind. So what she's in charge of Aquitaine in France. That's like sort of her fiefdom. Well, and that's hence the name Eleanor of Aquitaine, who's also sponsoring the first generation Grail troubadours, and so is her daughter, Mary of Champagne. So Aquitaine itself is the first Duke of Aquitaine was Clovis the First. So we're talking here 507 AD. So Clovis the First, the Merovingian, which is, he was also known, they were known as the sorcerer kings, even after they so-called converted to Christianity. These were Viking killers, they were warlords, and they had a negotiation, an agreement with the ruling families of the Roman Empire after the Roman Empire began to collapse under the weight of its own contradictions, and they were given the authorization to be the arm of power to reconstitute the new Roman Empire. And so, and that involved certain stories that had to be concocted to justify why this particular, because like why the Merovingians that came to be known as the Franks, the Frankish kingdom, why them, why would they become the top dogs and not somebody else? Why not the Ostrogoths or the Goths or the Visigoths or any of the other rival Viking kingdoms of pagan human sacrificers, right? Like why them? Well, this is where the brilliant idea of concocting certain Gnostic stories, esoteric stories, knowable for the inner elite only, that repurposed stories from the Bible and then added some creative writing to justify notions, for example, that they were the blood of Jesus. How were they the blood of Jesus? Well, in the secret teachings that were then concocted by these mostly hermetic Neoplatonist nests. Some of them seem to be pretty embedded within the Coptic Egyptian church. Some of them also are embedded. Well, there's a few different nodes of control in like the first 2-3 centuries AD. And they're creating certain different Gnostic cults that are all giving their own coloring to what the secret teachings of Jesus are and what the secret, you know, Sethian, Luciferian spirit of Jesus actually was for the elite, whereas the public Bible is for the stupid people in their myth. And that in this world, there you go. That's Abraxas, one of the archons. Rooster-headed archon with snake legs and a warrior body that Carl Jung believed that he was, an avatar?
He was he was of Abraxas or something?
Of Abraxas, yeah, that was one of the demons that Carl Jung felt he was animated by and wow. was in communion with. Yeah, there's his seven sermons. Carl Jung's seven sermons that were kept secret for over a century until I think like 2012 or something. And then followers decided the time had come to allow his red book of esoteric art and esoteric inner beliefs to be made publicly available, including his seven sermons to the dead, where he's going through, you know, his interactions, his necromantic interactions with Basilides, the early Gnostic prophet, enemy of the church fathers, and Abraxas, an early archon. So, and there's like a whole cult of death, sexualized death that kind of comes with these stories. And so I'm just saying this because in their mythos, Jesus didn't die. He actually had babies with Mary Magdalene, and Mary Magdalene went from Palestine to the south of France and there gave rise to and nurtured her little babies who all became then the Merovingians and hence continued to procreate under the protection of certain secret orders that we've seen sort of recounted to us in things like Holy Blood, Holy Grail,
The Da Vinci Code,
and, you know, sort of rendered for popular consumption. But this is a recounting of things that are, to a certain degree, still actually believed by the upper management of this thing. And if you think about it, even like Holy Blood, Holy Grail, what is Michael Bagnon? Michael Bagnon, who is one of the two or three authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, he is openly an initiate of the Quatuor Coronati Lodge. The Quatuor Coronati Lodge is, like I said, the Edward the Seventh, Charles Warren being the Grand Master of a big part of world Freemasonry back in the 19th century, who then runs the Jack the Ripper murders. You and I talked about that in a previous show.
Oh, wow. And that's probably how they have the Vesica Pisces kind of thing with the Jack the Ripper murder, even within this.
That's a strong observation there in that title. I didn't even notice that. That's correct. They're obsessed with the Vesica Pisces. And so, yeah, the configuration of it right there between the two O's on the title of the book, that's a no-brainer. Yeah. And the fact that the Jack the Ripper murders, the ritual murder of these sacred prostitutes, according to this, whatever they're reading, whatever grimoire they're using, that's telling them that that's what you do. If you want to like usher in a great working, is you got to like kill these sacred prostitutes and position them geographically in such a manner that reflects the Vesca Pisces, which is, as you and I talked about in that previous episode, exactly how the five canon, like main sacrificial prostitutes were positioned exactly, in Whitechapel, England in 1889, or 1888.
Have you read that new book that came out, about the other serial killer, with, I think it's the Murder House, with, the white, it's something White City or yep. something.
Yeah, it's H.H. Holmes. H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. Mm-hmm. And they're popularizing his story. It's even in mainstream franchise bookstores all over North America right now. They've got even like little shows and movies that they're cooking up for public consumption around this guy.
Yeah, I heard Martin Scorsese might be even doing something, rumor has.
Yeah, and he's probably into some crazy occult stuff. Oh, he is. I mean, he definitely not probably into, sure. He is into that. I suggest for people who want to know more about H.H. Holmes and Holmes's role in the Jack the Ripper murders, because there is a connection, is to read the last couple of chapters in my Edgar Poe's Final Mystery book, the volume 3 of my Revenge of the Mystery Cults. Of course, reading all 3 volumes is the best, but you don't have to. You can just read volume 3 if you want, and it's available online on Amazon. You can buy it as a paperback or whatever.
Nice.
But his murder castle was definitely, he disappears, and his great-grandson has been doing a lot of useful research into his great-great-great-grandfather. He's got a Facebook channel that he shares all of his information. I think some of his research was even being turned into a reality TV show where they successfully exhumed. He got basically, because he's the great-great-great-grandson, he was able to exhume or authorize the exhumation of his great-great-grandfather's body where it was supposedly buried. And I guess it was in Chicago. It must have been Chicago, because that's where he did most of his killings at the murder castle in the Chicago Fair, right? So it was the Chicago World's Fair that the serial killer is doing his murder. And there's a whole story. We can almost have a whole show on this.
Oh, we will. Yeah, we definitely will.
That's a picture of it. It was, he designed it so that you could have as much murder and torture as possible, and nobody could hear you scream, because the walls in each room were totally soundproof. He had secret chambers, secret rooms, through the walls into the deep basements. He had, within the boiler room, all of the tools needed to dissolve bodies. So God knows how many people he says when he was finally caught, because he was killing children too. He admitted, he basically said he was possessed by the devil and had to do murder the way poets do poetry. You know, that's the way he describes it. And he admitted to killing something like 27 people. It might have been a lot more. Difficult to say. They basically demolished the building in the early 20s, and then they said, "Oh, it's all fiction. None of this was true. It wasn't really a murder castle." But they demolished all the evidence anyway. So nobody really, you can't say that they know what they're talking about. But when the great grandson exhumed the body, they found that whoever was buried in the location that we were told was where his ancestor was buried was not the same person, because the skeleton that they exhumed was something like 3 inches shorter than the official height of H.H.H. Holmes. And the fact that H.H. Holmes was also, he disappeared for the 6 months that the Jack the Ripper murders were happening. He disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to him. His grandson thinks that he went to England and at least participated. I don't think there was simply one Jack the Ripper per se. I think there was probably a number of people who were associated with Conan Doyle and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was Conan Doyle being the founder of Sherlock Holmes. The name might not be a coincidence. Sherlock Holmes in Conan Doyle's story, I think you and I actually went through this a little bit when I was showing maps. Conan Doyle, a year before the Jack the Ripper murders, creates on this, he creates an address on Baker Street located right above the London Tube, which happens to be the location that I demonstrate in my book. That's the home office of Sherlock Holmes and Watson that he creates a year before the Jack the Ripper murders.
Wow.
A year, right? Now in my book, I demonstrate that the actual office of the key Rosicrucian black magician who's overseeing the murders, and you could prove it, who is tied to Madame Blavatsky in a direct way. He's tied to Eliphas Levy. He's tied to Bulwer Lytton, the top magicians. Bulwer Lytton and Eliphas Levy are doing satanic rituals together openly. So they're also popularizing, like Bulwer Lytton is popularizing ghost stories as we know them. He's creating the new Rosicrucian order that sets up in 1867. He's doing a lot, but all that to say, this guy, Rosalind Donston Stevenson, who's a journalist and friend of Charles Warren and was with Warren in Jerusalem when they were excavating Solomon's Temple in 1867. This guy, Rosalind Donston Stevenson, who's the initiate basically he's very close to Blavatsky's esoteric wing of the Theosophists, which is also overseeing the creation of something known as the Isis Urania Temple. That's part of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in England that same time. So this guy has his office where he has a cosmetics laboratory that he creates with two Theosophical witches of Blavatsky who are part of her esoteric circle, who end up becoming co-founders of this cosmetics company one door down from where the fictional Sherlock Holmes office is located in Arthur Conan Doyle's story, right?
Wow.
What the fuck? Like,
yeah, they're probably using some of like the you know, I won't get too graphic, but you know, to keep their looking good with those cosmetics.
Yeah, you know, the mind can go places, right? When you're dealing with cosmetics and human sacrificers, and you're like, okay,
what we hear about today with the cosmetics, how they're using different, you know, body parts and stuff. It's,
yeah, very strange. Yeah. No, I know. I don't think this is a new thing, right? So that was a bit of a tangent. All that to say, Michael Bagnon.
Great tangent, though. Great. Yeah.
Michael Bagnon, who's the co-author of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that's later recapped by Dan Brown, who puts forth this in a popular consumption fashion of the secret bloodlines of Jesus that gave rise to the royal families of Europe. He is himself a member of the Quatuor Coronati Freemasonic Research Lodge, overseen by these guys. I'll say one more tangent. The treasurer of the Quatuor Coronati Lodge is Sir Walter Besant. Now that's something to keep in mind, that he's the guy who, with King Edward VII and Charles Warren, is the treasurer and key figure. He writes a lot. Very powerful figure of the 19th century occult empire stuff. And he's the brother-in-law of Annie Besant. In large measure, there's enough evidence that he was largely the handler of Annie Besant, including after her divorce, when she goes through her epiphanies and becomes a high priestess of Isis and replaces Blavatsky as the head of Theosophists. So to say that there is these interesting points of anomaly that tell a story for those who want to look for causes. It's there, right? And again, a lot of this I tried to lay out in as summary fashion as I can in the Revenge of the Mystery Cults story, the trilogy. So that's Aquitaine. That's Eleanor Aquitaine. She is the Duchess of Aquitaine. That Aquitaine is the center. The first Duke of Aquitaine was Clovis I, the Merovingian. It seems to be tied to all of this. There is a penchant towards certain particular families that have a role to play in things. Some play a bit more of a sacrificial role in things. Others, you know, and Cynthia, again, if you really want to see a deep dive, like that's even beyond what I do, check out Cynthia's currently ongoing series on these dark operations going on under the surface of things. It's currently on her Substack, and it's a crazy wild series.
The whole Stuart sacrifice connection was very interesting.
Yeah, that seems to be something that we're brushing on. It's hard to think about necessarily, but it seems like the Stewart family as a family plays a sort of sacrificial role akin to the story of the Pelican, which has to sacrifice herself, you know, by getting the babies to drink of the blood. But there's also certain occult parallels to the story of the Phoenix and the Pelican. So that's also a dual story that is believed that the Pelican might even be an incarnation of a Phoenix, and the nest might also accompany an idea of burning the nest to reconstruct sort of order out of chaos, which does seem to be part of the Rosicrucian Phoenixing ritual. Now, I brought up Francis Yates before because I was making the point that just like Shady Wasserman, Yates also knows her stuff quite well. So we're reading her Rosicrucian Enlightenment book, and it's there that you're finding the most useful clues about the connection of the Order of the Garter and the later emergence of Rosicrucianism as a new movement, but was never new. And she's very giddy, and she makes several not so subtle hints that it seems everybody misses when they read her books, that the Order of the Garter was an earlier iteration of what becomes the Rosicrucians when they emerge with their manifestos in the lead up to the 30 Years' War, which is sort of like one of the most demoralizing, wasting bloodbaths since the 100 Years' War. And it could largely be seen as a phoenixing ritual of Solvit Coagula, which utilized a similar fragmented idiot puppet, similar in psychological profile to Edward III, in the form of a guy from the Palatinate called Friedrich V. And Friedrich was a young guy. He was, again, fed and managed by courtiers, by handlers whispering images of grandeur and you know, grail-type romantic stories of his own grandeur that basically fed into this heroic story that he told to himself, that he is responsible for ushering in a new age of mankind, a new golden age. And he had certain people like Christian of Anhalt, who was a major Rosicrucian. You had people like Michael Meyer. You know, he ended up marrying a Stuart. So James I, who is the Scottish king that replaced Elizabeth in like 1602. James I had a kid, a girl named Elizabeth Stuart. And she was married off to Frederick V. And together, they were both young, same age, and they were both like worked upon by the networks of Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon had really taken control of most of the English counterintelligence and broader cultural dynamic at that time. And he was even writing certain mystery plays for them that were performed at their English wedding before they went back to Bohemia. That's where the location of the Palatinate was. And they basically set a trap. And you know, again, Cynthia goes into a lot of detail. Francis Yates is useful, and pretty much, you know, you have what's known as the Rosicrucian fervor happening because of these pamphlets, anonymous pamphlets that are circulating across the courts of Europe. One of them is the Fama Rosicruciana. The other one, the following year, is the Confessios of Christian Rosenkreutz, who's a fictional character, but a fictional character who embodies, I think, archetypally actual high cult managers who were managing these chivalric orders. And then finally you have the Chemical Wedding, which reads, when you read the Chemical Wedding, it reads kind of like identical to the ritual. Remember when I mentioned that Edward III, when he announced the Order of the Garter in 1344, he had this like multi-day ritual.
Right.
The Chemical Wedding story that takes people through a several day initiatory experience in this mythical kingdom, very similar, very, very similar to what was done earlier. And again, Yates is always alluding, like she knows what she's talking about, but she's always alluding that this is very similar to the Order of the Garter. This is very, but she's speaking to people who know. And she's also making the point that the Jesuits that had been created about 80 years before the coming out party for the Rosicrucians are the Rosicrucians, that the Jesuits and the Rosicrucians are two sides of the same thing that work together. And you can see how they work together in a number. Again, Cynthia's essay series for the people who want to do the heavy mental lifting and reward themselves by doing that work. And her series goes through the heavy lifting. But yeah, like the way
it works, everyone's got to go subscribe to Cynthia Substack. It's and yours as well. But I mean, it's off the hook. Like
it's off. It is. It's like this is like the type of training you need to have if you're going to be able to like navigate in this realm of reality. You got to think at least on the level of mental rigor of the enemy, and then better. So, and the enemy is very rigorous. They don't let their minds get sloppy the way a lot of us being part of the lower sort of the lower slave families that we're supposed to adapt to. The cultural norms that are set for us bring about bad habits of mind and emotion that keep us far removed from the type of caliber that we need to get towards if we're going to be able to both understand and then develop creative solutions accordingly to the type of evil that's baked into, you know, the current game plan. Why am I? So I'm just saying this because, so how does this Jesuit Rosicrucian thing work together? It's a useful practice, right? To think about this, because the Jesuits were created as an order within the Catholic Church, not dissimilar from what the Templars were created to become, right? As sort of the warrior defenders of the Pontifex Maximus. However, there's some certain things that are different. And Albert Pike even said the Jesuits are basically Templars. The Templars were just more unsophisticated Jesuits because they didn't have the subtlety. Yeah. And this is Albert Pike. And he knows what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So what did they do when they were created is that they were assigned to to manage the Habsburg Empire. That became their primary domain of exerting control over education, over political and military systems. And they were very good at infiltrating, but their purpose was to make everything as totalitarian and rigid as humanly possible. And the Catholic, you know, the Spanish Habsburg and then the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg, which are two sides of the same Habsburg operation. They're both assets of this Gnostic thing that utilizes as a point of control the Vatican. It doesn't mean that there aren't good popes who fight against this, and there aren't good cardinals, and there aren't good bishops and priests who fight against this. That's true too, but that's the most convenient way to express their control is through the center of Rome. And Rome would utilize the Habsburgs for doing a lot of the dirty work. But the Habsburgs were then the Jesuits were applying themselves to managing and making as rigid as possible the life of people living under Habsburg control. Like you had no freedom of conscience. You had to, if you were going to if you didn't adopt the exact same doctrine of what the state prescribed, you were a heretic that could be burned. Like it was really quite bad. The education was very strict and suffocating, no creativity. So it was very, very, it was totalitarian. So they do that in order to create an environment that welcomes or incubates Luciferian rebellion. So not all rebellion is bad and not all rebellion is good. Legit rebellion is good. Hence, American Revolution has a lot of good. But more often than not, we find it's contrived rebellions that are done this way. And so that's what Frederick V found himself thinking that he's going to be the savior of mankind and finally stand up and overthrow the totalitarian Habsburg Empire. And what he ends up doing is he gets tricked. He's positioned to be the head of the Protestant League. And the Protestant League is kind of like a NATO structure with mutual, you know, security pacts of all the different Protestant kingdoms, and Germany's made up of like hundreds of little baronials, some Catholic, some Protestant. It's a mess. But the idea was to like unify it under this thing, this league. And because he was the head of the Protestant League and he was the Prince Elector Palatinate, his vote counted for two votes of seven elector votes. And he was induced a crowd of people were sent over to demand he make himself emperor, pretty much. And he goes and says, okay, I will be the new emperor. I will crown myself emperor. And as soon as he does that, he's basically threatening he's declaring war, whether he knows it or not, on the entire Habsburg Empire, which is exactly what goes down in 1620. And you got, you know, he's known as the Winter King, because they're only in power for like barely a year, like one winter. And they carry out this battle that's going to like save the world, and all of the organized invisible white hats who have been promised to the readers of the Rosicrucian manifestos, who have been organizing covertly under the surface, will now come to the surface all of a sudden and overthrow evil and restore a golden age. And they're using the language a new golden age will emerge. And, you know, things that people today might find a little bit too unfamiliar in the language of what we're hearing coming down the tubes.
Well, even all the stuff you're talking about is exactly what's going on right now with the big push of these same ideologies. But even after the lockdown, what happened in 2022, the kickoff of these wars for over the last 6 years with, starting with Biden coming out on 222 at 2:22 p.m. With the, you know, different war right after the lockdown. So it's just like this has been going on for over since the lockdown, like 6 years. So it's probably going to continue for like 30 years or something.
Well, that's the sort of thing they want to normalize, something super unnatural. And you can see like what they did in the 30 Years' War. Like as soon as this happens, the Battle of White Mountain is a total fail. Everybody dies. The Elizabeth Stuart and Frederick V escape, and they get some safe haven in the Netherlands in 1620. And the whole thing just devolves. And then for 30 years, Germany loses half their population. Like it's hard to imagine the numbers of death. But like half the population of Germany is massacred in 30 years of religious wars completely, until finally the day emerges where there's certain very, very strategic, brilliant minds around Cardinal Mazarin and his student Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the finance minister of France, who revived the spirit of Henry VII and Edward and Louis XI, the actual good kings. There's a few of them. And they revived that Augustinian Christian principle of statecraft and put an end to the 30 Years' War that were supposed to go on, I would say, for many more centuries. And that was the foundation of the modern nation state, was their Peace of Westphalia in 1648 that finally ended the religious wars and were premised on certain core principles that became the foundation of healthy international law. Like, for example, the respect of each other's sovereign borders, the idea that the benefit of each nation must be defined around the benefit of their neighbors. So that's actually the first article of the Westphalian principle that they always ignore in political science courses today, because it doesn't fit their Hobbesian model of how they want students to think about the nature of reality and how everybody is supposed to be assumed to be a beast against other human beasts in a war of each against all forever. So, but the actual principles of what made this viable and functional and as a peace treaty is completely ignored. But that's what I try to recount these stories, because I find it's more valuable to get us to think about like, well, what are the solutions to our current similar problems of, you know, Rosicrucian witches trying to run scams yet again to depopulate us with a variety of techniques that have been done again and again and again, and can only be solved by a certain paradigm of thinking that breaks us out of that trap. So I don't know if that tells the story about the Order of the Garter and stuff, but that's the most of it. And that ties right into the American Revolution. So if you don't get the key figures in the battleground around the Peace of Westphalia and the creation of the nation state, people can't understand how did the American Revolution happen by followers of Jean-Baptiste Colbert and Mazarin, who organized in the United States at this point to continue on and add to the accomplishments of the Peace of Westphalia and the earlier nation state system of Louis XI and Henry Tudor VII earlier on. So there's this movement of actual perfectibility and progress by this healthy human thing that seems to express itself and make the discoveries in science, the revolutions, the positive revolutions in the arts, and political statecraft and the science of freedom. Like that's a more, it's something that's harder to appreciate because the evil is so ubiquitous sometimes, to just see evil, which is powerful, doing a lot of damage all the time. But the power of good and creativity is actually more powerful. And I think the oligarchy knows that, which is why they work so hard to get the Francis Yates's out there and the Wassermans and all of the political hacks to rewrite their histories in a way that ignores or that erases the true reasons why freedom improved and why goodness was able to thrive at different moments instead of this evil dark age thing. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, this has been wonderful. Like, and now I totally, it's connecting all the dots on the Order of the Garter. It's a, you know, something I really wanted to know about. I see people post about it. And thank you so much for giving us this. It's simplified, but it's very deep as well. But I followed along with it all. And you said something that I thought was really incredible is the earned knowledge, those two words together, the earned knowledge. And I think that's what I've been working on the Wicked Smart journey, is the earned knowledge of reading your books and going even deeper than just the podcast. So everybody, please go subscribe to Matt Arrett's channel, but also grab his books, you know, and your articles are great too. That's how I learned about a lot of the technocracy gray coat connection there. Wow. And a lot of fun learning. There's a couple things that I did want to bring up, but we don't have to.
Go ahead. Yeah, we got some momentum going. So yeah, go for it, man.
Such a solid presentation of this Order of the Garter. I guess what I could do is go to the super chats and thank everybody. I just didn't want to interrupt. Thank you so much, Michaela Ollett 5446, who's been a member for 4 months. And he says, hello to everyone from Nepoin, Saskatchewan, Canada. Shout out to Canada. How come everybody I'm a big South Park fan. Yeah. Canada, you know.
Canada.
Well, Canada was hilarious. How did was South that Park funny was, for Canadians, or was that like?
Yeah, that was pretty funny. It was pretty. Okay. But you know, when you know what you know, when you start looking into like what actually is Canada, you're like, whoa. What I thought was funny for one reason is all of a sudden way more real than I imagined. Like Trey Parker and Matt Stone were actually dropping some. I'm not saying they were doing this consciously, but yeah, you really can blame Canada for a lot of really bad things at the end of the day.
Yeah, I big fan. And thank you. The Mud Flood Monster became a new member. Witsius. Thank you so much. Gifted another 10 memberships, which you can go grab. The first people that can grab it. They get the exclusive content. Thank you so much, Witsius. He says, you need to check out Brown's latest that deals with non-local consciousness in Qtel and Golems. Brown is in Dan Brown?
Yeah, he's probably talking about Secret of Secrets. I would imagine. I didn't finish reading that. I just actually read a little bit in the airport for free. I didn't realize that he was getting into InQtel, but the thing itself takes place in Prague and the underground of Prague.
Where the Golem is, yes.
Yeah, which is interesting to me because I was just in Prague for a week with Cynthia and exploring some of this stuff. So it was interesting that that's where he sets his... And that's also where the story of the cause of the 30 Years of War as an occult working was initiated, by the followers of John Dee, the Enochian, you know, followers of John Dee and Francis Bacon were all up in Bohemia, which is the stage set by Dan Brown. I didn't read it, so I can't speak to the rest of the story of the InQtel angle, but.
Well, I get my mom this book because she actually read the Da Vinci Code, like the whole book. And Witsius, thank you again for the other 5 memberships where people, you could go grab these and become a member, get exclusive content. And now I got to feed that kitty cat. Thank you so much for everyone's support. My mom, she read the Da Vinci Code. And this was a while ago, whenever it came out, when it was like 2008 or something, I don't know.
Earlier even, I think, yeah.
It's funny because she was reading this book like about the Illuminati, they bring it up in it or whatever in secret societies. While I'm on my own, like Jordan Maxwell journey, learning about Illuminati. So I just think that is kind of cool.
yeah, you guys were having like a parallel set of experiences.
She's wicked smart, you know. So, one of the things I wanted to bring up was some of these books. One of them is this book of the Secret Founding of America, because we have a lot of influencers, and I won't say names, but people know probably, you can connect dots, the mainstream influencers that are giving us the truth and whatnot, that seem to post a lot of the symbolism of the secret society saying this is the solution to the problems, is, and then they show the symbols and they, in the ideologies of a lot of these orders. And even, which is very fascinating, you always hear about the Sabbatai Z, you always hear about him and the Frankist and whatnot, but the omission of the Knights of Malta and the Jesuits, and you bring it up to these people that are these big famous, you know, celebrities now, they say that's stupid. That's for weed smokers. I don't know why they're doing that, but maybe they're not educated on the subject, or maybe they got that paper, you know, they're getting paid.
I don't know.
But can you tell us a little bit about this book?
Yeah, sure. Well, that came to my attention due to an interview that took place between Milo, or what's his name? Not Milo, the formerly gay MAGA influencer.
Yeah, Milo. Yeah, I've been studying geopolitics for 10 years before I started my channel.
Yeah.
And this character and these different characters emerged on the scene. It was a grift where they, and I would watch him. I'm like, oh, this is cool. You know, like this one, you know, Ben Shapiro, Milo, they would go to these colleges.
Yeah.
And they would just, you know, own or just talk crap to the college kids. It was very entertaining at that time.
Yeah. So Milo's talking with this influencer that you're mentioning, and I'll just say her name. It's Candace Owens. It's Candace Owens. And they're talking together, and this clip that they have goes viral. And in it, she's talking about her own awakening to the reality of the fraud of the American Revolution. And she talks about how it's only been since she has found herself in certain Anglican churches being taught by certain Anglican priests that advised her to study this figure, Nicholas Hagar, and specifically the Secret Founding of America book, which I found so provocative that I decided to buy myself a copy. And I've read it, and I'm going to write something on it sooner than later, but I have to do more work because it was more sophisticated than I realized when I read it, because Nicholas Hagar is kind of like, remember we were talking about, you know, Wasserman, and we're talking about Francis Yates. He's kind of like that as far as the caliber of his assignment to create the new narratives that acknowledge what is usually not permitted to be acknowledged about our deep history, especially the role of Freemasonic societies and the occult. So he's supposed to acknowledge it, but then retool it in such a manner that still benefits the oligarchy at the end of the day and destroys our ability to think about causation. So that's the purpose. So there's a lot. He doesn't footnote, first of all, just to be clear, there's like hardly any footnotes. There's maybe 72 or something in the whole book, which is already like kind of, if you're not willing to like put yourself out there and say where some of your claims are coming from, you're not willing to be held accountable, that's already a bit of a red alarm. But anyway, there's still a lot of really, really useful things in this book. And Candace Owens is pretty much saying how she realized that the American Revolution was a Freemasonic fraud designed to run a Luciferian overthrow of the Christian divine right of king system of the British Empire, which she's saying the world was better when we had divine rights of kings managing the world instead of these fake Illuminati run republics. And so that's the narrative. And I'm like, whoa, that's weird that you're doing this. Weird. So my first question was, before I even read the book, I was like, who's Nicholas Hagar? So I you know, did the Wikipedia search, and I'm like, just reading his bio, and I'm like, oh, okay. All right. Well, there he is right there. So he's old, he's 86. And he's been around, and you read his bio, And this guy is clearly, yeah, he's got a whole section on his espionage career where he was assigned to spy on Gaddafi. He was assigned to also oversee counterintelligence operations against black nationalist movements, which would have tied him into the sort of, you know, African British run MK Ultra style operations that would have been driven by South Africa and Belgium and Britain and France in the 1960s and 70s, killing pretty much anybody who had a tendency towards becoming a leader to rally the people to freedom. He was always working closely with MI5 and MI6. He was the personal tutor to Emperor, one of the sons of Emperor Hirohito, whose name I'm forgetting. So he's the personal, he was assigned to be the personal tutor of, Hitachi, Prince Hitachi of Japan. So he's pretty high up there, and he wrote a lot of books touching on a variety of topics. And this particular one, I had to read it. So basically he's acknowledging useful things. So I remember when I mentioned that, Frederick V and Elizabeth Stuart, after the Battle of White Mountain in 1620, which is a bloodbath, they ran off and found sanctuary in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
They did, when they arrived, it was just a few months after the movement of English colonization via the Netherlands had begun. Cause the, King Charles I, who later gets his head cut off he's a Stuart king, he's doing some pretty big clampdowns on religious freedom, and it's becoming very suffocating for people who are not following a certain party line to just be themselves and to follow their conscience. So they're like, you got movements of Puritans and other groups that are fleeing England. Netherlands is providing safe haven to a lot of these people, and that becomes the beachhead by which you have a lot of ships that end up setting sail to the New World. So he's acknowledging certain truths that tie us into the story of he doesn't talk about the 30 Years' War, but he does talk about the Rosicrucian movements. But then what he does is he acknowledges this battle that broke out in Massachusetts between, on the one hand, you had John Winthrop Jr. And what I know, because of my research, I know that this battle led by John Winthrop Jr. was a Platonic Augustinian movement, though they were operating within the Puritan sort of banner. They themselves were situated epistemologically, philosophically, culturally within the Augustinian tradition, which is the Platonic Christian tradition, which has always been the only thing which has resisted successfully this evil parasite. All of the other like splinter groups that branch off calling themselves Christian tend to always just be typically different flavors of the same evil in controlled dialectics. So the Augustinian tradition, it's more than just a faction. It could express itself. It's a way of thinking about God, yourself, creation, and how we should comport ourselves to make things better for humanity now and into the future. So it's just this other philosophy, let's just say that. Now I'm saying this because they were at battle with an occult network. It was called the Antinomian Controversy. Now, Haggard touches upon it ever so briefly, but the Antinomian Controversy, again, people can Google it. It's the first major existential threat in the new colony of Massachusetts between two different factions, one the Mather, the Winthrop faction, and the other being the followers of the hard occult witch covens, who are expressing themselves in the figure of Annie Hutchison, who's there's no smoking gun that says she's a witch, but when you look at the Free Grace Antinomian movement that she's leading, that professes to make the Bible irrelevant by virtue of initiates getting divine revelation that allow them to sort of create their new scripture. It's the same type of formula that was behind the growth of the Gnostics, you know, 1500 years earlier, that battled the early Christian church with the Gnostics. You know, the idea was if you go through your rites of initiation, you can become literally perfect, completely without sin. And because of that, you have direct experience of God. As such, you are, you can channel that divine message of the angels and whatever through you. And then that becomes the foundation of new cults, new gurus building new cults, that, you know, and the guru is always above right and wrong, above good and evil. And that's the sort of thing that was spreading. And one of the attractive elements of it is it's usually premised around what makes these free grace movements attractive is that, number one, there's usually some overly heavy-handed Jesuitical kind of like behavior for the established order that makes the established order look very unpalatable. People don't, you know, they see it as hypocritical. They see it as suffocating. There's that aspect that tends to be one element of the formula. But the other one is it's often accompanied by the promise of a lot of the justification of a lot of hedonism. So all of a sudden, the body becomes more sacred than it should be. You know, the fleshly pleasures becomes an act all of a sudden, not of shame, but of a sacred journey towards God. Drugs, you know, psychedelic drugs, which were active in those days too. It's like mushrooms and ergot and other things. It's not a new thing that came out of the CIA and MKUltra in the 20th century. It's been around for thousands of years. It's just that it went big at that time in the 20th century, but it was a big part of the initiatory processes too, which is it could be scary, it could be fun. You're seeing like spirits and demons and shadows, and you're tripping out pretty much, right? And under the control of certain stories that you're told in your initiation, that are the same stories told to everybody, you can have common dreams, you can have common hallucinations based upon what your imagination has been wired to mentate over, right? To fictionalize over in your mind, so that when you've had the shared dreaming, because of the shared stories, because of the shared tales, now all of a sudden you have similar shared hallucinogenic trips, which also, because it's shared, reconfirms in people that, oh, they must be seeing the same demon that's then reinterpreted for them by a higher priest or priestess that tells them what they experienced. So there's a common sort of script that's generally followed for these processes. Now, all that to say, Annie Hutchison is running one of these things, and she's being her patron is Sir Henry Vale, and Sir Henry Vale is the first governor. He's a British governor of Massachusetts, an enemy of John Winthrop Jr., and he's providing protection to John Wheelwright, the brother-in-law of Annie Hutchison. And there's a war, and this antinomianist controversy goes on for a couple of years. Finally, the Augustinian faction under Winthrop is successful. They expel Annie Hutchison and Wheelwright, and these guys basically go off and they found a new colony, and two new colonies. They found Rhode Island, Providence, and then they found New Hampshire. So that's founded by these occult antinomianists who are setting up this new thing. Sir Henry Vale ends up giving up. He's exasperated and his plans fail. And he ends up going back to England to advise. He ends up becoming a knight in England by Charles II, who he later throws under the bus in the phoenixing operation that becomes the English Civil War in 1649. Charles II Stuart gets his head lopped off, and there's a potential in England for a new renaissance. There's some really good people in the Republican movement in England, but they're overshadowed, and they basically are not victorious at staying in power. And unfortunately, this Rosicrucian movement around Henry Vale ends up becoming the advisors to Oliver Cromwell, who ends up making a mess of things on so many levels. But the whole thing was probably unworkable. I don't think it could have necessarily worked. There's just too many scrambled eggs everywhere. But so Massachusetts ends up surviving those fires, and it ends up founding the basis of what becomes the core Republican movement. Now, Nicholas Hagar, he's flipping everything inside out. So he's talking about a lot of the elements that I'm talking about, but he'll flip things around to make those people whom I know are playing a positive role appear to be the evil ones. And the people who are doing the evil thing, he makes them appear to be the underdog heroes. So he acknowledges the different factions of Freemasonry, but it's where he puts the emphasis. And so it does its job of convincing many people who read that book, because it was published in 1987 or something for the first time. It's been republished so many times in different languages, including Candace Owens, who's become now a convert to the aristocratic reinterpretation through her initiation into the high bloodlines of the the House of Lords of England, and these chivalric networks, these orders that permeate the Anglican Church that was co-created with the Jesuits, by the way. The Anglicans and the Jesuits are also two sides, a feminine masculine path of one thing. They just take on different roles at different times, but they're created in the same year by the same operators from Venice. So just to say, it's the same thing. Now that's what she got absorbed into. So she's playing a certain role, whether she knows it or not. I think she's a smart girl. She's got a lot of charisma and a lot of wits. I doubt she fully understands what the game is that she's playing a role in as a part of the game board, but it's clear what it is. When you approach it top down, as far as the move to, affect the new phase of this Templar revenge, which involves, eliminating, getting the Jews to become Zionists, or as many of them to become Zionists that don't even understand how they're being used and inflamed with their own sense of chosen people, blood and soil cultishness, in order to then be the triggers of their own annihilation, and ultimately the justification for reinstating Templar, Crusader control over a new kingdom of Jerusalem that Pete Hegseth and company are so committed to restoring as part of some new religious ritual for a new age that they want to invoke through the fires of a phoenix, which is why you have even people like certain Weinstein brothers out there doing sermons basically on the importance of phoenixing the Republic, phoenixing the world. So I won't go into more names. I could name a lot more names of influencers who are all invoking the same phoenixing language, including Nicholas Hager over there. So it's, when you know this history, you got a lot more to sort of like cut through some of the misinformation. If you don't, it's easy to get sucked into a lot of it. It's admittedly not easy.
Wow. That's incredible. Thank you for breaking that down as well. Like, this has just been fire podcast, and we're over the 2 hour mark, but I know you do a lot of stuff. I guess what I'll do here is just a couple of the last slides. You don't have to add anything. It's just something I was reading on your articles over at Substack. Maybe I just wanted to show some people the different things of Tony Blair receiving the Order of the Garter. So this is still here. Like, we're going all the way back in time. And then we even got this stuff going on today. And here's another one that I thought was interesting. Churchill refusing the knighthood honor. The rejection of Carter Order breaks tradition. Thought that was interesting.
And what's the Carter Order?
I don't know what the Carter Order is. Who knows? I don't know. The National Socialist roots of the House of Windsor. I say that so I don't get,
Yeah. In trouble. Yeah, Scott Thompson, that EIR article, I read that, and Scott Thompson did some really magnificent work for EIR throughout the 90s on a lot of this stuff. Some good leads with that researcher.
Yeah. Okay, I'll read this then. Churchill, and I don't even say this word.
Oh, really? We can't say that word?
Well, I guess you can, eugenics, Churchill and eugenics. These are just articles that I found on your page that I just wanted to bring up some of the slides. And if there's anything that's in your head, I thought this was interesting. I never heard of the Gormogons, a secret society. I like to always learn about the secret societies. And I was like, oh, there's the Gormogons. And I got a couple picture of the Gormogons right here. I don't know if this
is. What is it? Like, where are the Gormogons in this picture?
Maybe they're not the Gormogons, but this is a Gormogon picture that showed up. Maybe it's not them. What is that? That looks like a lizard person. It looks like a reptilian.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in that thing. That's a strange parade. Yeah, that's an ugly baby.
Okay. I'm gonna deep dive on that. Yeah. Here's the Gormagon medal.
Well, it looks like it might have some maybe Jesuitical connection because it has the sun that has the what looks to be is it how many rays are there? Is that 16 rays? Because if it's 16 rays, that could be the Jesuit sun. In this case, it might be more
16. Than 16. It's 16. Huh? So it's cut in half. It is 16, just like the Smithsonian's.
Well, the Smithsonian's 32, which is double 16. Okay. But it's still Jesuitical. It's a little tip of the hat, and yeah. It's punctuated by straight ray and a curvy ray. So yeah, it's a Jesuitical symbol. The fact that you got two dragons as well pointing at each other. There's probably some significance there. Maybe the Order of the Dragon might have some influence. I don't know. I don't know who the guy is on the left though, with the weird like Incan or whatever it is, hat. Not too sure who that is. Is that a Pope or something or?
I don't know. I just found that when I was looking at your article, and I was all like, it was a society. Primary objective was to hold up Freemasonry to ridicule.
And it was accused of being a Jacobite leading group. That's useful to know because the Jacobites are the Freemasonic, typically Freemasonic networks devoted to restoring the House of Stuart to the British throne. So like Aleister Crowley is a Jacobite. Most of the Hermetic Order, the Golden Dawn are Jacobites. They're all committed. That's one of their rallying, their organizing principles is the restoration of the House of Stuart, which they see as culminated by the child of William and Kate, who because of Diana, they say because Diana was indirectly an heir of the Stuarts, that that the bloodline is being restored in its more pure way now.
Okay. Interesting. So everybody go subscribe to Matt's Substack, his YouTube channel. I appreciate you so much for coming on for the long show. What would you like to let everyone know before we sign out?
Oh, I think you did a great job of doing the PR for my books and stuff and Cynthia's Substack. So I wouldn't necessarily, movies, maybe, one of the things I know books can sometimes be a little bit heavy right off the bat for some people, but we've made a lot of documentaries, that are mostly all available for free at this point that can be found on CanadianPatriot.org. And there's like in the main menu section, an area called films. You just click on that. And you could binge on our movies that we've made. We've got a little production studio now that's been around for about 3 years. And we've made something like probably like 15 solid films, maybe more at this point. So most of them are free.
Nice. So I got those links down below. And also, I don't want to forget any of the super chats. Just to make sure we did do this one. Vampire Jack gifted 5 donut memberships. Thank you so much. Very, very kind of you. He was here last night and also gifted membership. So please, it's first come, first serve, whoever grabs the memberships. And Witzia says, I'm reading Dennis King's bio of LaRouche comments.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, Dennis King is basically a hack for a network that ran a salon that was tied to the Trilateral Commission under a figure by the name of, what's his name? It's been a while since I thought about this stuff. Cause I used to be involved with the LaRouche organization as a full-time member. So I would always encounter the slanders, and Dennis King was assigned to write sort of the authoritative gospel of the evils of LaRouche. And he was like, yeah, he was an author, a regular author at High Times magazine, which was a major Rockefeller operation to promote mass drug legalization in the 70s, 80s. And so he was part of that thing. He was brought into these John Train salons. So John Train created a network of salons in the early 80s when LaRouche was becoming a little bit too influential amongst certain policy circles that were being won over to his strategic vision. Both within the United States, but also abroad in Mexico and in India. Indira Gandhi had also commissioned him to map out a policy program to fight back against the IMF and World Bank. So did Lopez Portillo of Mexico, who did something similar and brought in LaRouche. You could listen to Portillo's speech at the UN after he was organizing, or he was organized by LaRouche. And he basically calls for a debtor's moratorium to fight back against the vulture funds and IMF with a positive program to nationalize the privatized petroleum industries and to finance a massive renaissance program. But that required cooperation amongst other Latin American countries, which unfortunately was sabotaged. Anyway, you could sort of map out a lot of LaRouche's influence during that period that also exposed the entire banking system's control of drugs in the Dope Inc. book that published over a million copies and was circulated to policymaking circles around the world. I still know people who have read that book in the 80s. So that was, he also had the America's second most subscribed to science magazine called Fusion Magazine. That's Dope Inc. If people can find it, buy it, own it, read it. You can see why he made the enemies and Kissinger specifically pissed. The actual people that John Train and Dennis King were working with during their crackdown on LaRouche, which went on throughout the 80s, it involved both a propaganda slander campaign on the one hand, but it also involved real intelligence operations on the other. I mentioned Fusion Magazine was the second most subscribed to science magazine in America in the 1980s, which was bringing together all of the leading cutting edge fusion scientists that had been iced out by this priesthood taking over control of Rockefeller science in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So the greatest minds were all rallying around LaRouche's science magazine. They were speaking at the conferences that he'd organized around the world. He was running candidates for office in America that were actually winning, which was also verboten because they weren't vetted by the inner clubs. So that was also a big deal. So I'm saying this just because when you look at what was deployed to run the, like, so the FBI and John Train, on top of the propaganda operation and everything else, they were also running a crackdown where the FBI basically raided their offices. Huge FBI, hundreds of FBI agents like raided the office. It was overseen by the guy in charge was Robert Mueller. That was Robert Mueller's first big hit job. And LaRouche was given like 15 years hard labor in prison for a conspiracy to defraud the government. A lot of his leading collaborators were given like 80-year sentences, expected to die in hard labor in prisons. Like, it was shut down. And it was crazy because what they did is that the FBI confiscated all of the infrastructure, all of the subscription lists, all of the printing presses that the LaRouche organization had built up. And then they couldn't have any revenue to pay back people who had invested in their political campaigns and in their magazines. So then these people who didn't know why they're not getting their money back were being told by Dennis King and company that you were being defrauded and that's why you're not getting your money back. And they didn't even realize they were giving testimonies to news agencies and to other things saying that, yeah, we got defrauded for my money. But it's like, well, no, actually, the entire infrastructure and printing presses and everything were all confiscated. So they had no more revenue. They were bankrupted. And that's what shut down this Fusion magazine. The Process Church of Final Judgment also plays a key role. So there's a book. Hold on one second, because it's important to me, right? I spent years studying this and mapping out like what is the story. I talked to members who lived through it, who went to prison. I spoke to ex-members, many of them who weren't even friendly to the organization, to get all sides of the picture. So I've done the work. That's the Process Church. The key prosecutors against LaRouche in trial were actually members of the Process Church of Final Judgment, which is a Scientology satanic church, which is kind of ubiquitous today in shaping a lot of the culture and political systems, including military intelligence. I'll just say that. It's tied to Charles Manson, too. Here. One second.
Wow. And that's wild thing about the High Times. I didn't know that was like, I know that magazine. Okay.
So I'm saying this partially right now. I'm taking the opportunity because this came up in a recent dispute that surprised me between myself and Courtney Turner, who's been my friend now for a while. And I didn't realize to what degree we had such opposing epistemological methods. I didn't realize it until it kind of came to the surface when she wrote a very lengthy hit piece on LaRouche about a month ago, which involved a lot of Dennis King references and a lot of other things in it that I know, again, because I did the work, are outright lies. However, it's not easy to prove that necessarily in an easy conversation. But all that to say, here's the book I just pulled off my shelf. And this is produced by those members of the LaRouche organization that avoided going to prison in the 90s to present the actual case and the facts available that they were able to pull together of who were the key players, including got there Dennis King on the one side, and you got John Train over there, who's a CIA operative running the Paris Salon review. Chip Berlay is another figure who plays into this salon operation that's proven to have been the organizing thing. It's a really good book. It has a list as well of the various members who went to jail, and also goes through the filings, the individual transcripts of the cases, how the first case in Massachusetts was actually going to get thrown out, and the jury trial, the jury actually admitted that they were going to that the evidence being brought to their attention during the case was so unbelievably fraudulent that they were going to unanimously elect to exonerate LaRouche and company from all accused crimes, except that the judge, who was himself tied to the Process Church of Final Judgment, again, read the book Railroad. You can get it online for free as well, but if you can buy a physical copy to underline, it's also useful. He actually canceled he basically declared the case null and void before the jury could pass their judgment and moved it to Alexandria, which was much more controlled by the CIA at the time, and just streamlined everything so that within like a week and a half or 2 weeks, the gauntlet came down and evidence that should have been inadmissible was brought in. It was the defendants weren't even allowed to defend themselves in court for some reason. That I forget the details of how that happened, but again, read the book. It's thick. So yeah, Dennis King is pretty connected to very, very dirty operations. And unfortunately, his works, just like, you know, Nicholas Hagar and Francis Yates, he's vetted. And so his works are highly, highly promoted, translated, republished, as far as like LaRouche and the American fascism story that he published and all of the articles and slanders. And then you got like some ex-members who were basically in the 70s, radical Trotskyist Marxists who never really produced any original material. They never did any original creative work or discoveries, but they were there as members. And then when LaRouche made it very clear in the mid to late 70s that Marxism and Trotskyism was no longer going to be tolerated in his organization, and he went to war with the Trotskyists and the Marxists, and making the points as well that they were, most of them were just being funded by the Rockefeller Foundation as controlled opposition anyway. And then he basically adopted an American system reappreciation that he didn't fully understand until the 70s, when it was brought to his attention that there was this American system of political economy that when he discovered it, that became the core focus, is reviving a study of what this was that's been written out of our textbooks. And all of the Marxists who were formally tolerated were all of a sudden treated like non grata, and they had a big grudge on a big chip on their shoulder. And a lot of them quit in anger, thinking LaRouche was like the sellout CIA agent, because that's what the Marxists were led to believe. Anybody who's promoting saving America as a CIA agent and attacking, you know, communism has got to be a CIA agent. So they started becoming recruited to a growing roster of former members who started giving testimonies that were then used to say, hey, look, even former members are saying it's evil and a bad thing. So it must be because they were members. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, like there's other reasons why people say things that you're ignoring that might involve, you know, them being given incentives, just having infantile grudges, being organized by a higher process that maybe they don't even always understand. Maybe. But all that to say, I've spoken to a number of them over the years. Does, you know, and I've tried to do the best that I can to make sense of what the hell happened throughout the 80s, 90s. Where do these scare stories about evil LaRouche come from? And it doesn't add up. What I can say is LaRouche, as a living, thinking human being who chose to develop, use his time in a certain way of making discoveries and sharing the method of how these universal discoveries were made, both in his lifetime, but also rereading the original writings of people who did make discoveries and threaten the control system of the oligarchy. He did the more than anybody alive that I know of to really declare a successful cultural war on the oligarchy itself, and made so many enemies who were very, if they couldn't destroy him physically, they were happy to destroy him by reputation. So character assassination, and there's an art to doing that. So I would suggest go to my book. If you want to understand more about LaRouche, there's that book Railroad, or there's the Science Unshackled book that I wrote back in 2023, which also features my assessment of LaRouche and Plato's method, both in several forms, as well as how this method has been applied to make major breakthroughs in plasma physics and other things that people might not realize. So that's Science Unshackled, Restoring Causality to a World in Chaos, written in 2023 and available. That's it right there. Available on Canadian Patriot Review. And I think that would help as well to answer and clarify some of those questions.
Wow. That was wild about the High Times magazine. I didn't know that was connected to Deep State as well. And thank you, Jacob Israel, up in here, $5 super chat, says, everyone smash that like button.
Yeah.
For the donut. God bless everyone. Thank you, Jacob Israel. I'll give you a call after the show. He's great.
Cool.
Thank you, Jacob
Israel. The name sounds familiar, but anyway, okay.
Yeah, he's a big YouTuber. Really cool, nice man. My channel, he brought me on when I had a very small channel, and very nice.
Cool. I'm just also following a little bit of the comments here. Witsius also says, still, do you acknowledge his Marxist roots, Matt? Yeah, sure. But now here's the thing. So LaRouche, when he originally became a public figure, was 1968, and he didn't have it figured out. So he was teaching a non-credit course at Columbia University on physical economy. Now at the time, because he didn't have it all figured out, he was trying to make sense of things as best he can. And he was watching at the time Martin Luther King died, John F. Kennedy. And so unlike other professors who are just kind of like learning how to shut up and go along to get along, he actually decides to try to create a student movement to resist this Rockefeller takeover at the time that he's teaching, right? So early on, he's operating from a cultural anti-imperial milieu inside of the United States that has a Marxist sort of literary or intelligentsia within it. And he's finding that the most anti-imperial students are typically rallying at that time around the what's called the Students for Democratic Society, which by and large becomes revealed to be mostly a CIA Rockefeller Foundation operation. So he himself, though he's using like that milieu, he's using, if you like read his book, he published a book in 1972 before he discovered this American system that is not either Marxist and it's not British capitalist. It's something totally other, and it's more tied to this history that I was going through. But before that, if you read his book, Dialectical Economics, just read it. It's available online. You could see that he's using language that is similar in tone to what you found in Das Kapital, as far as like, you know, concepts like the productive powers of labor, the anti-imperial critique of how capitalism can be used as a cover for feudalism. So you'll find like those elements are there. And that's true that capitalism can be used to extract wealth from target nations under the veil, the lie of private free markets. That's the way the British Empire was successful. So to that degree, for the negative proof against empire, Marx was not totally untrue. There, that, but that's not what makes Marx so evil and dangerous. So to that degree, you'll find some of that in there. You'll find the language that recognizes the importance of increasing the productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer. Now, Marx doesn't talk about per capita and square kilometer. That's LaRouche's contribution. But you'll find certain language that's similar. And in fact, it is true that you do, as a society, have to always increase the productive powers of labor if you want to avoid the Malthusian trap that promotes depopulation and population constraints. That's, you do need to do that. What Marx doesn't do is he doesn't allow for the harmonization of capital and labor. So Marx presumes, he imposes onto this system an artificial fallacy called the class struggle as an unbreakable organizing principle of society, that there's always a class struggle, that if you're in the upper class, you have to exploit the poor class. If you're in the poor class, you have to be exploited until you become a pressure cooker, at which point you have to overthrow the upper class and then become the proletariat dictators until you start suppressing the weak, until they do it all over again in some cyclical neurotic behavior. That's not there in LaRouche. So LaRouche always rejected that. He also made a point, when you read his writings, that private enterprise is extremely vital for creative incubation and discoveries, and private ownership is also very important to providing the incentive to go beyond the limits of your expectations. So that's also one of the bigger dangerous Trojan horses infused into Marx's system, is the abandonment, the illegalization in his ideal utopia of private enterprise, or private enterprise and private ownership. The idea of permanent class struggles. There's no idea of a harmony of the parts, which makes sense when you look at where did Marx come from, and why was his Das Kapital published in three volumes beginning in 1865? Where did those ideas come from? Did he generate those ideas himself that are contained within his Das Kapital? No. That is not true. What you find is that he was stealing concepts that had been developed by the followers of the American system school of Henry Clay, who coined the term the American system as a different system of political economy that is anti, not even different from British free trade, but is an anti-British system. So that Henry Clay, the Alexander Hamilton movement, that were themselves followers of Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the finance minister of France, who organized the Peace of Westphalia and ushered in these major economic development projects that were kind of reviving the Cameralist traditions of Henry VII and Louis XI. So you have this continuity of a movement that even scientists like Gottfried Leibniz is developing and consolidating as a concept of a science of happiness and a science of physical economy, which then takes on a very strong form after the American Revolution. And again, if you look at the followers, people like John Quincy Adams were major supporters of this system of political economy, as was William Harrison, the assassinated president for 3 weeks in president before they killed him, and Zachary Taylor, and then later on was Abraham Lincoln, was a follower through the networks of Henry C. Carey, who was his leading advisor, and also the guy who Karl Marx was stealing his ideas off of. So, for example, one second, I'm going to be right back, okay?
Yeah. Very interesting stuff. Everybody, please smash that like button.
All right. So I'm back. Thank what I'm going to show you are a few books here, right? What people can do is test out what I'm saying. So you can go. I picked up a few of Henry C. Carey's books, one of which being Harmony of Interests, Agricultural, Manufacturing, and Commercial Interests in 1851. You can read Henry C. Carey's Past, Present, and Future, his refutation of Carlyle's Past and Present, and also his refutation of the entire school of David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Adam Smith, and Thomas Malthus. You could read his three-volume Principles of Social Science as well, published in 1859. You could read also his followers in Germany, like Frederick List. and Frederick List's writings on the outlines of American political economy. And Frederick List is the founder of the Zollverein, that basically modeled on the Hamiltonian customs union of creating a federal debt with a constitution that transcends the limits of what the Articles of Confederation were permitting in the very weak, compartmentalized early U.S. state before the Constitution. And that was Hamilton's brainchild that allowed for a new type of system of economy to be created that gave the U.S. the ability to defend itself and to quadruple their population within only 40 years. And that was then replicated in Germany by a man who came to the U.S. for 5 years, Frederick List, in the 1820s, studied this system and brought it back and got murdered by his British enemies in Germany. So you can read all of that stuff. And then you could realize, as LaRouche later on realized, is that the things of value that you could find are useful within Marx's Das Kapital are there because Marx stole them. And it wasn't probably even Marx, honestly. He wasn't that bright. It seems like it was more his handler, Friedrich Engels. And even today, most Marxists even have to admit that you don't even know what Engels wrote versus what Marx wrote. And a lot of it was probably written by a British grand strategist by the name of David Urquhart, who ran the British Museum, which was where Marx in London spent a very long time coming up with all of his original ideas, was at the British Museum, overseen by its curator, David Urquhart, who's like managing Marx. So I think it seems to me that, again, the anti-imperial critiques come from Carey. They don't come from Marx. The aspects of Marx's system that have usefulness, like Marx's rejection of Thomas Malthus, overpopulation, the principle that societies need to always increase the productive powers of labor. These are useful things, but they don't come from Marx. They were stolen from Carey and the Hamiltonian school and then repackaged under this new Marxist doctrine after the U.S. Civil War. Because why? This American system program was spreading around the world by followers of Lincoln and Carey in Russia, in Germany, in France, in Latin America, in Argentina. You had the Drago Plan. You had Benito Juarez in Mexico adopting it. You had people in the Meiji Restoration in Japan adopting it, bringing in Henry C. Carey's key allies like Erasmus Peshine Smith, who's advising the Meiji Restoration government right now in the 1860s to 70s. In how to industrialize and get over this samurai chivalric knighthood insanity that was keeping the whole nation in a backward state for centuries. Unfortunately, as we talked about in today's show, that didn't work out. And the British enemies of America ended up taking the control of the mind of the emperor and reviving the samurai ethos of the warlords in a new way with big weapons of mass destruction. So all that to say, this is the type of thing. Read LaRouche's Dialectic Economics and look for what is not contained in Marx. So number one, he's thinking about solving problems and recognizing the need to harmonize private and public sector, but also the idea of the individual that is capable of making discoveries of various amplitudes into the structure of reality and applying those discoveries in the form of new technologies that allow for the material increase of potential population levels at higher standards of living and at better qualities of life to be fruitful and multiply as like, that's like proper Augustinian Platonic Christian economics. So that's always there. And when he finally realizes in around 1976, that was the year that three books were published. You had Dope Inc. or 77, three books were published in that year. You had Dope Incorporated, which I noticed the Witsius has a copy. You had Nancy Spanis's Outlines of American Political Economy, which I have on the bookshelf over there, and it's probably still available, compiling the original writings of all of the figures around Leibniz and the pre-American Revolution that gave rise to the best of what Hamilton and Lincoln did. The other book was called The Civil War and the American System by Alan Salisbury, who was the first one to rediscover Henry C. Carey. He was an African-American leading member of the LaRouche organization. His work on Edgar Allan Poe was revolutionary and informed my research that I took to. If it weren't for him, none of the work that I did on Poe adding to his discoveries would have been possible. So that Salisbury was a very special mind who did very unique things.
the 1949 comic writer?
Nope. Okay. He's the author of this.
No, okay.
It's upstairs. But he did the work on The Purloined Soul of Edgar Allan Poe. He did work on, like, so he revealed, he's the one who rediscovered the American system. And so when LaRouche had encountered what his members were bringing to bear, because his members were using this very important method of analysis that bears fruit in making discoveries, he then began to, instead of just simply tolerating Marx and allowing people to, on their own time, you know, discover where Marx is lacking, he ended up then fully going to war with the Marxist ideology and everything else when he had that knowledge. Without that knowledge, he didn't have the means and the conviction to understand how it was needed to go to full war. So that's how to explain that change in tone from LaRouche's early 70s writings to the post 1976-77 period, where there's a change in tone, right? And yeah, so I've explained this as well to the friend who I mentioned, who's a bit confused about a lot of this. Oh, it's not. And Witsis is saying, sorry, I touched a nerve. No, I'm not saying this as you touching a nerve. I'm saying that this is actually really important. And I'm using your question as an opportunity to put on record a bunch of thoughts that I've had in my mind, which I have not yet had a chance to properly process and compose anything directly on. So I'm seeing this actually as a very useful thing, Witsis, Harry Lidwig. And that's specifically why I'm giving it the attention that I'm giving it currently. That's pretty much, and I'm probably going to make this a separate little video or a couple of videos to share around, and maybe, you know, our friend Courtney might check one of those out. Not that I haven't explained a lot of this to her already, but that's another thing.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know anything about this, so thank you to learn about it. I've heard the name and all that. Very smart, wicked smart Matt Arrett here with us. This is probably one of our longest podcasts, but I can't leave without re-bringing up, because I was a stoner when I was a teenager. Not anymore, you know, sober, reading books, you know. But you brought up the High Time magazine, and I just want to, which that was connected to some of the programming, because I didn't even think about that. It's so interesting.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was part of the MK Ultra operation.
So. Wow, I was MK Ultra with the.
We all were, dude. We all were. I was.
but thinking about, that's what this is very inspiring, because hearing about this Arthur story and all the different like trips that were shamanistic, but with different like priesthoods putting people through these different hallucinogen rituals, and then creating a story of the entities that they saw, and then just bringing that today with the music, of whether that's country music with all the different alcohols that everyone's drinking, or if that's hip hop with the codeine or whatever, and the entities that people will see on those, and then the music. It's so fascinating. I appreciate you, Matt, for coming up on here.
Always a pleasure, man. This is always a fun recreational part of my week. I love these chats, man. So yeah, it's great.
Well, you've been tuning in to the Order of the Garter, the Hidden Hierarchies of Power and the Reset of 1348 with Matt Arrett. Everybody smash that like button. Much love and God bless you.